of the money. Call this September 2nd, 2022 meeting of the Legislation and Rules Committee to order. Can I have a roll call, please?
Mr. Marley?
Here.
Mr. Brady?
Here.
Mr. Bartlett?
Here.
Mr. Stanley? Dr. Angel? Mr. Fontrin?
Here.
And Mr. Leeds?
Present.
All right, we have a quorum.
Thank you. Call to the public. Members of the public may address the committee during this call to the public for no more than 3 minutes. Pursuant to ARS 38-431.01H, the committee members are not allowed to discuss or take legal action on matters raised during an open call to the public unless the matters are properly noticed for discussion and legal action. However, members may ask staff to review a matter or may ask that a matter be placed on a future agenda. Is there anyone who wishes to address the committee during this call to the public for items that are not specifically on the agenda?
No one from the public has communicated with us that they wish to appear today.
Great.
For the record, Dr. Angel has appeared on the call.
Okay, so Dr. Angel's here. Good morning, Alejandro.
Good morning, Ed. Great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Good to see everybody.
Adoption of minutes. Approve, modify, and or reject September 20th, 2021 L&R committee minutes. Do I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion. Peter Leeds.
And do I have a second?
Second, Mr. Fondren.
Thank you. Is there any corrections to the minutes as presented? If not, all those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
For those on the phone, you'll probably have to call them by name.
Yes. So, Mr. Fondren?
Aye.
And Dr. Angel?
Aye.
You have others on the phone? Sorry.
No, that is it. We have a seven-member L&R committee,
okay.
And there's 60 present.
You're asking an architect to count.
I don't have them on.
All right. Well, motion stands approved. On to agenda item number 5A, review and discussion of board statutes for possible future legislation.
I guess I could quickly present. This is Kurt Winder, Deputy Director. What we have here is basically staff has presented to the committee a number of issues that staff sees with the board's statutes, and that we would like the committee to consider possible revisions or at least discussion regarding them. We would like to have something presented to our legislature this session, so I think all the changes that we have presented to the committee today probably is a bit more than what can be presented to a legislature at this time. And so we would like you to look at them, distinguish which ones should be prioritized, and then possibly go into a deeper discussion of those rules at that time. But of course, the committee is able to discuss whatever we'd like regarding our statutes or whatever we'd like, really.
So I think we've really, the staff is thinking, you did a great. Dr. Angel, sorry. I'm getting back in the groove of in-person meetings. I apologize. I always keep forgetting.
No worries. I was just hoping Kurt or someone from the board could help us with the timeline. I mean, so we're looking at these changes today. How soon do we have to all be on board or on the same page as to what goes on to get someone in the legislature to sponsor a bill for this?
Thank you, Dr. Angel. This is Judith. So that's a great question. We are truly in a time crunch right now to have something prepared for this next legislative session. So I do have a senator that I believe would be interested in sponsoring a bill for us. But all of this is legwork, right? And then whatever we come up with needs to go immediately to the board, because obviously we wouldn't pursue anything without the board initiating that request, and then go to the senator and say the board would like, you know, these changes if possible. And it would need to go to be looked at by Ledge Council and things like that. Ideally, it would need to be completed and a bill put into place maybe by December. Actually, even it could be November or December, so that it's ready to go in January instead of waiting until January to drop a bill. Because you know how many bills are submitted and don't even get heard, that kind of thing. So that being said, there really isn't a lot of time. And I think what Kurt was trying to express is that there is so much work we could do and I think would all like to see done with our statutes. But we have to be kind of careful and selective on what we are looking at right now. Considering all things, including the overall climate of regulatory affairs, let's say. So, did that help, Alejandro?
Yes, that's very helpful, Judith. Thank you. I just wanted to understand the process, and I have some ideas on what things I'd like to prioritize, but I'll let the discussion run first in case others have other items.
No, I think unless others want to step in, go ahead. Just keep the floor.
Yeah. What would your priority be?
Well, I think all the items that staff worked on are great, and I mean I'm behind all of them. I would probably suggest that the definition of engineering, maybe there needs to be a little bit of a discussion as to what we want to do there. That's the only one. I mean, I have really minor comments on them, but the definition of engineering may be something we want to work with NCES on. If we are going to move forward with the bill, I think one key part that needs to be in there is the licensure by endorsement and addressing 32.126, which also talks about the exam waivers and all those things. I think similar to the 2019 bill, that would be seen favorable by the legislature because it's not just about adding powers to the board. It's about, you know, streamlining the registration process. So a bill that combines that with other provisions, I think, would be a good bill. It also seems that we need to, in any bill, address our administrative process to move cases through it. So that those are, I think, two things that have to be there. The other things, I like them all. I don't know if people have an order of priority for those.
Well, this is Ed Marley. I think from my perspective, Alejandro, you're correct. I agree. I think working on the engineering definition is important. I think whatever we do, and I haven't actually seen the results of the Supreme Court judgment that I'm assuming has been issued. Did they issue an opinion on that?
Yes.
I haven't seen anything, you know, actually been able to read anything on that. But I think whatever we do, if there are shortcomings in that decision, I think we need to make sure that whatever we promote addresses those issues that were raised by the court.
And I believe that's the second item that Alejandro was mentioning about the enforcement process, because one of the things in the opinion was that they felt the individual did not have a mechanism to compel the board to go to hearing. And they cited a couple of other boards that have that in there. So, and Kurt has addressed that in some of the proposed language.
Okay.
So.
I think regarding the 2019 legislation, I think that actually, as I recall, and Alejandro or Leroy, you guys were on the board at the same time, I believe that actually made it through the House and Senate and then was vetoed by the governor as he felt that it was in competition with his bill. And so I think knowing that a new governor will be coming into place, regardless of party, we have a little bit more of an open door because they more than likely don't have that history. And so we stand a better chance of getting something like that through since it did pass through House and Senate
in
the past.
And you are absolutely right on that. Kurt researched that, and actually I know Alejandro did too. And the reason it didn't, you're right, it passed the House and the Senate. It's comedy reciprocity, which we all very much want. I mean, nationally, as a staff, it's a win for everybody. Easier, you know, for people mm-hmm. moving state to state. And you're right, it was directly in conflict with the governor's initiative at that time for the universal licensure. However, now, at this stage of the game, with a, you know, in the next legislative session, I don't think it would be any kind of stretch to show that universal isn't really the ideal necessarily, and comedy and reciprocity would be much more effective and helpful to our applicants. And as you know, most of the professions, they're registered in multiple states. There's hardly any that are just registered in one state. So, and then, correct me if I'm wrong, Kurt, but I believe that if we were able to do that, that we would also, and I know, talked about this with Julie too, we would be able to eliminate the PE exam waiver, the professional exam waivers, not the fundamentals, because it wouldn't matter. We would need it, because if we had the comedy and reciprocity and they had been registered in another jurisdiction for 5 years, and we're holding an active license, you know.
So currently, the statute reads for a waiver that you have to be registered in another state for 10 of the last 15 years. The comedy language says that you've been registered for 5 years, so why waive an exam when it takes half the time just to get registered through endorsement?
Yeah.
So they're probably going to be not needed anymore if this were to go through, but that's something for you guys to discuss as well. If it can just be updated or changed, it could be another option.
Since we're still in the 2019 legislation, I believe one thing we had written in there was, because right now it's really confusing for our in-state architect registration initial applications. They have to meet the three-year requirement that's in statute. And one thing we had written was to just simply accept the duration of the NCARB AXP record, which is less than 3 years. But I think if we get a blue cover from NCARB, we approve it. They may not have the 3 years, but we approve that. And so it's set up right now. It's set up as an unfair advantage to I guess we're comedy still. I can't keep all the terms straight. You know, it's set up as an unfair advantage to our initial registrants in the state of Arizona. So I want to make sure that we bake that into whatever language we're doing, so that we simply accept the AXP. And I think we need to be looking even further down the road, because, you know, we're looking, you know, everything's not duration based anymore. I mean, we're starting to really take a serious look at competencies versus duration. And so, you know, we're going to have to be a little more dynamic, I think, in how we approach this.
Is that in model law?
That's in model law. We could get the language for AXP. The whole competency discussion is ongoing and fairly new, so that's not going to be in there.
And I was going to say, I think that is a thing that happens with our architect applicants, is that they have the AXP, we get it, and they don't have enough experience based off of our.
I just did one for a staff architect I have who just got licensed, and she was scrambling at the last minute to fill out a verification form for me to sign, because she was short 10 months. Mm-hmm. She had finished AXP. Mm-hmm. Tell you what, she's one of the most competent people I have. So anyway, so I think that's something that we really need to look at. And again, it's an easy one to pass, because it actually makes registration easier for our in-state folks.
Do you know at the top of your head, is that statute or rule?
It's a statute.
Mm-hmm. I think both, but I think the challenge is that all of our professions are lumped together, so that's part of the, you know, everyone's required to take the 8 years. So if we were to break up architects,
actually they're segregated, I think, in the statute. I think they actually break. I thought they broke out architects separately.
They're on 32.122.01. Okay. One of the things that we want to do, but you guys weren't representative, is that we wanted to take every profession and give it its own 0.0,
okay,
whatever. But that wasn't presented here because it was just not enough.
Okay. Yeah.
No. We want to separate them so we can get it more specific on each one, because right now they are currently lumped.
Yeah.
Under that one, and see if I can bring it up.
Because I thought land surveyors already were a lower.
Mm-hmm.
They're a lower amount. They're already broken out.
Yeah.
But the others are all together.
Yeah. So the 8 years.
Oh, I see.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
So question. I mean, there's a lot in the packet, and I don't know if the plan is for us to dive into each area individually, or if we're looking first to an overall approach. Because I think, there's a question in my mind: do we throw everything into one bill and see what sticks, and see if someone's willing to run it, and if we see if we can get buy-in, or does opening up our entire statutes, could it backfire and end up with changes that we don't want? Then is it better to have a focused bill?
I
don't know the answer to that. Just wondering out loud.
I think, in my opinion, I would like to see us go for maybe a more focused bill. My concern is some of the language that we're proposing here in our packet is to restructure the board again, to add an engineer to it. That might be a little more politically risky and might want to be a standalone bill or something. There's a couple ways to look at it. Sometimes you lump everything into a bill and it gets passed because not everybody, they don't always read the whole bill. But at the same time,
the intent of the board composition change was to get a seat at the table for home inspectors and alarm companies.
Right.
And then Kurt and I kind of arm wrestled about
the adding an engineer.
Yeah. And that's what we compromised on, was adding one more, but that would still retain 5 public members, and there would be now a board of 13 instead of 11.
And Mr. Leeds, maybe you can give some history. I go way back, not quite as far as we were, but in terms of when home inspectors were brought onto the board, I was actually a part of that discussion through AIA, and I remember there were some very specific reasons that home inspectors weren't included with a seat at the board. I don't remember what those were, but maybe you do.
We were appointed by the governor in 2000. He started certifying in 2002.
Right.
And never discussed the board until...
And I
would say maybe 10 years into the certification. Yeah. And I have never really wanted a seat on the board as a home inspector. I've seen the work that those poor people have to do.
I suspect that it's coming to mind now that it was almost like, and this is going to sound really horrible, and please don't be offended.
No.
The home inspectors they were forced onto the board.
Mm-hmm,
the realtors didn't want them.
That's right.
The registrar of contractors didn't want them.
We didn't want them either.
I understand. So they ended up on the board, and I think under the board leadership at the time, it was agreed, we'll let them come in, but they're not going to have a seat at the board.
Right. We generally have a home inspector in the public attendance to the board meetings, just mm-hmm. to be sure that mm-hmm. things are going right.
Sure.
We always have a board member on this Rules and Standards Committee that can represent us at the board.
Yeah.
Putting a home inspector on the board is okay for home inspections, alarms, surveying, possibly, but once you start getting into the engineering and architect aspects of complaints and assessments, the home inspector may fall short on his qualifications.
So, sorry, Peter, so are you saying that you feel less qualified than any of the 6 public members?
Not me.
Okay. So,
but many of the home inspectors.
Because
one
of my first speaking engagements was at the home inspector conference last year mm-hmm. for Arizona ASHI, and I felt like I took both barrels in the face mm-hmm. at angry home inspectors because they did not have a seat at the table.
That doesn't surprise me.
You know what? We've got 6 public members. You tell me anybody there is more qualified than at least the 2 professions that are regulated by the board. So,
my understanding of the board composition was public members, of course, but that the board relies on their professions to actually do the assessments. The public members have opinions on them, but the actual whether or not someone stepped out of line or did not step out of line, you fall back on your professions.
That's
for
done
that.
On the back end with the enforcement advisory committees and the assessments and all
right.
of that. But again,
I would not object to a home inspector or an alarm person on the board. Okay. as long as it's not me. And then because I have gone to so many board meetings and I've seen a stack of papers that these poor people have in front of them, and it's amazing. And, of course, they're all volunteers. I mean, they want that, so they take that. Putting a home inspector and an alarm person on the board with another engineer is, I would say that's fine.
I have no problem. Optics of it, if you're, I mean, they're only giving us one engineer right now, one architect, one of everything. If you go just by numbers of people that are regulated by the board, there's no difference in the number of geologists from home inspectors. Why wouldn't they just have a seat at the table? So I don't want to beat that one to death. I mean, to me, that's just easy. Whether or not we ask for another engineer, that's a little more tricky. But again, based on sheer numbers, what is it, Kurt? Like 60% of our registrants are engineers.
50% of those are civil.
And 50 are civil. So we should have two engineers at the very least, and one should be civil. I mean, just based on numbers.
I'm going to agree.
The other thing is through the years and through the multiple sunset reviews that started in the 80s, the engineers have really had power to influence and lobby the legislature in a good way. And
because
when you look at the amount of public works projects in the state that is done by professions, engineers really need to have another seat at the table, I believe.
I agree. I'm in agreement.
Hey, can you guys verify that's actually Leroy? He's saying good things about engineers?
Alejandro, I have verification. He's sitting right next to me, and it was him talking.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
And Alejandro, I want you to know that you're a positive influence on some of those compliments.
Oh, thank you, Leroy. Hey, no, I agree with all the comments. I'd love to have another engineer on the board. I have no problem adding a home inspector and alarm agent. But as Ed pointed out earlier, that's probably a politically sensitive thing, and it might also be something that the board is not, you know, aligned with immediately. It might take more discussion.
Sure.
It might not be a bad idea to separate the board composition into one bill and then the rest of the statutes onto another bill. I think my perception is that ACEC and others would support a change in the board composition as proposed. But it, again, it's not a straightforward thing, so maybe separate.
I think the thing we have to keep in mind is based on the current board composition, would it actually pass?
And that's why we kept the number of public members.
Right, would the board support the change, the current board?
Yeah.
And
I mean, right, to Kurt's point, that's why, I mean, it changes it by one, the public members, you know, from six to five. So
it's vacant right now, so nobody would lose their appointment.
That's right.
Right. We're not, nobody gets fired.
But the majority would change.
But we wouldn't have technically a majority of public members. But again, I have such a hard time with that because when you're looking at the rationale behind, you know, more public members than industry members, and we only get one or even two, how does that even, to me, it's not like having a board that has seven engineers and two public members.
There's another thing in relation to engineers. Most of our professions do not have the number of separate categories that engineers do. And by having at least two on, gives you a little more coverage of those multiple areas that come under engineering.
Yeah.
And we might even want to, not to wordsmith it right now, but we might even refine it so that it's a requirement like it used to be, that at least one has to be a civil engineer.
Yeah, I think we put that
in. And we may have put that in there. I did a lot of reading. And
get some stakeholder feedback.
I thought the original said at least one civil engineer, didn't it?
That's the original. How the original
I don't think that changed in Kurt's work. I don't think so.
Okay.
He's looking. I thought we did put that, but I didn't know.
Set my entire screen down there. from whatever I'm doing. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
yeah,
anyway, I agree. There's maybe more discussion on this item. I think we need to frame it as, look, we'll still have broad public representation on the board with 5 members out of 13, and it's more than twice any registered category to make sure no one profession dominates the board. So we achieve broad public representation while gaining some technical expertise on the board.
Have we had conversations with the alarm industry about their interest?
No, but we, Kurt and Julie and I will be attending their convention in October, and I guess we can try to reach out and speak to somebody before then, but we're spending a pretty good deal of time there in early October, right?
Okay.
No, mid-October, 19th and 20th, I think.
I guess from the discussions you guys had so far, it sounds like engineering definition is a priority. The
yes.
composition should be looked at possibly as a separate bill just because of the nature of it and what the board is currently comprised of.
Or at least let's find out from like ACEC or the associations that we would need to support a bill and of course the board on and get their opinion on that as well. Before we, you know, recommend one way or the other.
Okay.
Certainly. And then endorsement.
100% on that. I can't see anybody opposing that or even
no.
coming up with a reason why to oppose any of that.
Okay. Is there any other issues that the staff has brought up that you feel needs to be worked on, or should we just focus on what's been discussed right now and kind of look at that language and delve into it deeper?
Let's jump to financial bonds and E&O for and fingerprint cards for home inspectors.
Okay.
Can we jump that far down?
Sure, if I can find it.
Let's talk a little bit about that. The while you guys are looking for it, I checked with my bond company to see if they would offer a $100,000 bond, and they don't. Okay.
Okay.
Now, just to give you a history. We had a 3 mechanisms of financial assurance for home inspectors. We eliminated one because there's no way to do that. Some guy brought in a boat, wanted to use that as financial. That's ridiculous. So I understand why we got rid of the third one. The E&O insurance is the best way to go. All businesses, of course, have to carry liability and workman's comp and whatnot, and that's generally a $2 million aggregate with a $1 million each occurrence. Insurance. The E&O insurance was hard to get, especially when we started up as home inspectors getting certified. There was nobody that really offered the E&O insurance, so that had to be developed into the industry. And back in the day, it was costing about $3,500 to $4,000 for somebody with good credit. Now they want to check your E&O, they want to check your history, your credit and everything else, but the price actually has come down. A newbie coming into the industry right now for E&O insurance is going to pay, if he's exceptional, $1,500 a year. If he's not, up to $2,700 a year, which is doable. But back in the day when we were first registering, these guys couldn't get E&O insurance, and so we used the second mechanism, the bond, because they could get a bond. They could get a bond for $25,000. It cost, my first bond actually cost me about $2,100, and then over the years it came down. Now a $25,000 bond for a home inspector with a history, my history, 27 years in the industry, no complaints, no problems, is down to $500 a year. However, I called my bond company to ask them what they would charge me for a bond for $100,000. It went to Tokio Marine for the underwriter. They came back a couple of days later saying, we don't offer that bond, and if we were to offer that bond, your history is nice. The fact that you never defaulted or anything on that is nice. However, we want a full financial. They want not only your personal financial, they want your business financial, and then they want all your personal assets. Okay, so you're going to have to do a profit and loss for these people. So I'm wondering whether or not that's going to be feasible. And then they also told me, and then we're still not sure that we would offer that bond for $100,000. So I think if you're going to try to get a bond for the newbies coming in who are having trouble getting their E&O, you're not going to be able to go above $125,000. And on the other hand, it might be better to eliminate the bond option and make them go directly to E&O, because E&O is now being offered to newbies, but it's a very high initial cost. Now, I did get feedback from an E&O company that also said that that you're probably looking at $2,400 for a new person for E&O insurance. However, that probably will include his liability and his general liability.
$2,400.
All right, which is much better than it was 20 years ago.
Your insurance.
I stuck with my bond. The bond, it was the cheaper way to go. The bond was my way into the industry, and generally the people who are in the industry as they're working, they progress out of their bond into E&O insurance. However, I never saw the need to do that in 27 years, and so I never did. But the E&O insurance protects the client, of course, but the businessman buys it to protect himself, actually. So, if I had to make a recommendation, I would say either leave the $25,000 bond alone for the newbies coming into the industry, or eliminate the option altogether.
So maybe a little bit more research on that one.
Sure.
Because
like
it doesn't seem like it's equitable to have, I mean, one person can get a $25,000 bond. Or if this is in place to protect the public, insurance is $100,000, a bond is only $25,000. Mm-hmm. And you can't say, of course, just the only if you're in the first 5 years of your practice, because mm-hmm. it would be for anybody. I mean,
mm-hmm. it might raise a stink in the industry. A lot of guys are working with just bonds, and
I thought that we didn't see as many bonds.
Are you getting more E&O than bonds now?
There's definitely more E&O, but I still see probably like 15-20%, maybe a little lower.
That's pretty low.
Yeah.
That's pretty low on the applications, you mean? Or on the overall?
No, overall.
Just like overall.
On the overall, yeah, mm-hmm. because most of the guys will actually progress into E&O once they see what their liability really is out there, okay? But that's to protect themselves. That's a business decision that they make, mm-hmm. you see? And which is another thing. Do we want the state to take away the business decisions from the business? You know, these are questions that need to be answered, really.
I was going to ask, because I understand the point of fairness, right? So everybody, to protect the public should be protected equally, regardless of whether it's E&O or bonds or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the first question is, what's the normal exposure for a home inspector? I mean, do we know of a lot of cases where someone has gone through their insurance and used the $100,000, or does that never happen? Because this could range from everybody just needing $50,000 per occurrence or whatever, to maybe really needed to raise it to $100,000 or more because home prices are going up and the liability could be going up. But I don't know what the history is of the actual use of that insurance to protect the public. Anyone know?
I don't, but we can find out, Doctor, because the board doesn't deal with the money issues like that. That's done in civil court.
I'm not sure we could find that out.
Well, we can by asking through the industry, you know, asking home inspectors, in fact.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be an empirical study. I mean, we could ask, but it's not like we could want a report, and there's no way an insurance company is going to tell us that.
Right.
Oh yeah, these people made these claims,
no,
you know.
but I meant to maybe survey the home inspectors who would be happy to tell you that they won those cases, and of course they'd be unhappy to tell you that they didn't.
Maybe we could talk to the HRSD and maybe they could do an anonymous poll or something so that people might.
That's a good idea.
You know, I don't think really, they're going to want to say.
That'd be a good idea. I do know that on both the bonds and the E&O insurance, if they ever get hit by have to be utilized. The bond people may not bond you again. The E&O people will charge you an arm and a leg to reinstate.
Right.
Okay, because in essence, they're not going to let you go until you pay that back. So they're really good for a one-shot deal, and then you're going to, in essence, be out of business or you're going to pay through the nose.
Can I ask a quick question? How is the amount established? Is that just a number grabbed out of the air, or is there actually something?
How it was initially established, Peter, or maybe you?
I think it was done by research. The bond itself, no one was bonding more than $25,000, and the E&O, no one was offering the E&O for less than $100,000.
But a somewhat related issue, I saw that there was a question about accepting or not accepting the personal property as a financial assurance. And I think, in my mind, that that's problematic, personal property, because people's homes and vehicles and other things are protected even in bankruptcy. So
right.
Someone saying, I own a house and I can use that as financial assurance doesn't mean anything.
Understanding is
so I think that, you know, the idea of having E&O, professional liability, or a bond is great. And if 100,000 is the right number, but you can't get a bond for 100,000, then I mean, we can leave the option there. Maybe someone will provide it at some point, but if not, people will be driven to the E&O.
Now, they don't offer it right now, but they're interested in talking about it. My bond company says all you got to do is send me everything you know about your financial situation and we'll determine. You know, so which means all your assets, the whole shot. So it would just be tough. My only point on that, Doctor, was simply that we put the bond in place to help people get into the industry, and now if we go to 100,000, it would be a hindrance to getting into the industry as opposed to an E&O. An E&O would have been the quicker way in. Today, the bond was the quicker way in before.
And I think something I have concerns about is if we allow a newbie in with a $25,000 bond, but if they and as they get more experience, they qualify for this $100,000 in E&O. Well, to me, the point where you need the most protection of the public is when they're new.
That's right.
And not and they're getting minimal coverage, and then a seasoned veteran like you, that you know you're carrying it for, like you said, your own protection rather probably more so than public health, safety, and welfare,
right.
But that could come up in some cases. But
you're right, and the whole industry feels the whole industry, and the people I talk to, feel that $25,000 isn't nearly enough protection for the general, for the public.
Really,
okay, $100,000 probably wouldn't be either, but closer.
It's a good starting point.
Yes.
So I think as we look at this, we needed to make sure that we're putting the protection in place where it's needed most, and that's for the newcomers into the industry.
That's a fact. And the bond company also said that they would need the directive from the board, the bond language that the board settled on before they would even consider writing a $100,000 bond. This is what they did to us on $25,000 as well. There had to be a directive, and somewhere in our paperwork there will be a form that tells you exactly what the language.
Well, I guess a directive would be if the statute passed.
Yeah.
I mean.
Well, the bond language has to be written and accepted by us that we send to the bond company, and then they'll work it on that language. We did that with the $25,000 bond.
We have one of those actually on our website as well. The bond language can be looked up under home inspectors. What's it called? Additional documents that are available. So specific language that we have.
Right. We had the board had to provide that to the bonding companies, and they'll have to do it again.
Okay.
Good food, good thought, a little bit more research.
More research?
Okay.
But I think, Mr. Leach, you mentioned that even the home inspectors feel $25,000 is not enough protection.
Right.
So
that's right.
I don't know. Maybe the $100,000 is right. And we just leave the bond option. It might be expensive early on, but maybe it'll get cheaper over time.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, there's two other alternatives for people to pursue.
Right. It will get cheaper over time.
To raise the bond option to $100,000, Alejandro, is that what you're suggesting? So
that's what I'm thinking. I think, one, it needs to be equitable. Two, it really needs to provide meaningful protection for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it'd be great if there were a bunch of companies offering $100,000 bonds,
mm-hmm.
and maybe there aren't right now, but that doesn't mean there won't be in the future.
No, there will be. If we do this, there absolutely will be. And you're absolutely right.
Yeah, because contractors get $50 million bonds.
Yeah, it's a good way for them to make money. They will do it. And then on the other hand, the cost will come down as more companies actually take over.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Of course, at 2%, that'll raise my price.
Did you have anything else you wanted to look at?
Yes. A couple of things. On the Rules and Standards Committee makeup.
That's back to the board. It's put together with a board number one.
It's 32-1-1-11 Standard Rules and Standards Committee. I like everything that you've done here. With the exception of adding 5 home inspectors to the board. Now, I'm not saying I don't like it. I am saying I do want to tell you what kind of trouble that will cause us. Home inspectors are opinionated people. That's all they are. They give opinions all day long. Opinion, 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 opinion. And you put 3 home inspectors on the Rules and Standards Committee, we got 3 separate opinions that we spend all day pounding out to come to an agreement. You put 5 on there, the committee meetings will go on and on and on. It's nice to have a public member. It's excellent to have someone from the board so that we have representatives on the board. But you might want to think about how many home inspectors you put together in the same room.
That's why there's only one land surveyor.
Can we go to one half?
It's something. Now, you also have in here 2, moving them up to 5-year terms, which is good, throwing them out if they don't do the work, which is excellent because many of them don't, and then limiting their terms to 2 consecutive 5-year terms, which I think is a great idea, which I wish happened 20 years ago. And if you do get that passed, I'll be the only one in history that sat 20 years on this Rules and Standards Committee.
We'll get you a plaque.
Just put my picture on the wall. I'll sign it. But I like all the ideas. I just want to caution you about 5 home inspectors in the same room. That's all.
Appreciate your thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. I'm just knowing that you don't always get everybody that you need. Mm-hmm. 5 seemed like a nice buffer, and also the opportunity to have maybe some very veteran and mm-hmm. maybe some not as veteran, mm-hmm. and just a good mix. So
yeah, the not as veteran on the enforcement advisory committees is causing me a nightmare, but on the Rules and Standards Committee, where we're face to face, I think it'll be easier. The only other thing, what was that? There was one more thing on that. No, I'm all for it. Make the changes, and then back to the fingerprint card. All right. I have no problems. I've removed my objection to the fingerprint card after talking to Kurt about what you're doing with our fingerprints now. You don't have our fingerprints on file anymore. I always thought they were on file. Okay. They have to be destroyed. So the fingerprint card is a good idea, at least every 6 years. You'll know if somebody's got a problem, and of course, with a fingerprint card, DPS will contact you right away if there is a problem. So I have no problems with the fingerprint card.
And so it's not a fingerprint
it's
card,
a clearance.
Right? The clearance card, mm-hmm. which
right.
because depending on the board, there's still some boards that do the actual card, which
mm-hmm.
is only that snapshot of the moment,
mm-hmm.
and the fingerprint clearance card,
mm-hmm.
Julie's notified if something.
I don't have any problems with the clearance card.
We're good for 6 years. So.
You will get a lot of angry thoughts from the people who have never had to do that before, and now you're going to have them do that. Keeping in mind that it's a cheap card. I mean, it's $10 a year for 6 years, but it takes 5 to 8 weeks to get it. So if this gets passed, you're going to need to actually get the notices out as quickly as possible.
I got mine in 6 days, and that's the average for our
agents. Yeah.
6 days?
Yeah. It used to take much longer, but now that they do the electronic printing,
okay.
I think it's about 7 to 10 days.
Oh, then that's not a problem either. Okay. And the websites are still saying 5 to 8 weeks, but they're probably protecting themselves.
Yeah.
And for me, I know that this is an issue that will come up with our next sunset audit.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing the auditors will do is say, what, you do it once, that's it? I mean, if the whole point is to protect the public mm-hmm. for the professions that are directly in contact and in homes and that kind of thing, I know that's going to be an issue. So it would be really nice to be proactive on that one and say a current, you know, active fingerprint clearance card.
The current statute specifically says that we can't request it except for the initial. Denies us the ability to do it for renewals and things like that.
And, you know, I kind of feel like maybe that was an oversight when they went from the fingerprint actual cards mm-hmm. to the clearance cards.
I would think so.
We
did do that for the alarm agents and the home inspectors for a very long time. And the FBI would audit those fingerprint cards, make sure that we destroyed those that are supposed to be destroyed and everything's accounted for. We were very happy that they went away, you know, years ago when we had the fingerprint clearance card. But, again, there's no mechanisms currently in statute or rule that allows us to utilize that tool beyond the initial application of a home inspector. Mm-hmm. Whereas alarms, if that goes is invalidated because it expires or something else occurs to it, we're let known by DPS. If DPS were to tell us that about a home inspector, we don't care until they renew and they tell us what they did. Because there's no mechanism that allows us to take action. Mm-hmm.
So in conclusion, as far as the home inspector aspect of the agenda goes, I'm all for everything that you have here. Just want to remind you of the caution of 5 on the committee, 5 home inspectors, and the fact that right at this moment, they're not offering a $100,000 bond.
Thank you.
Okay?
Thank you.
Peter? Go back to definitions?
Yes, let's go back to definitions. We'll start with engineers.
Sorry, I'm on a single monitor, so I keep having to unshare and share back and forth
with
everybody, so just kind of bear with me as I have to do it that way.
He's also working off a little first grade size desk in the timeout corner.
Mr. Chairman, so on the definition for engineers, I mean, I see they picked up a lot of the definitions from almost every other state, if not all of them, so I appreciate being able to review that. My off-the-cuff suggestion would be that we try to adopt the NCES model law on this front for a couple of reasons. I mean, one is we can get support from NCES if we do that. Two is, unless there's something wrong with it, why not? There's been a lot of thought put into it already, into that definition. And ultimately, the closer we are to model law, the easier it would be in the future for licensure mobility. So, legislature put in statute last year is not very different from model law. There's just a couple of key changes that I think don't protect the public as much. But I would support just trying to go with model law if that was an option with the definitions from the model law.
I would agree adopting the model law. Of course, I'm a little biased because NCARB has model law that I'm promoting for the definition of architecture. But I think it puts us in a more defensible position because it's issued from a national organization mm-hmm. and it's more uniformly distributed across the country or across all jurisdictions. So I would agree with Dr. Angel.
Yeah, and the last comment in there is I think that the one thing that's hurting us right now in our statutes is maybe not as much a definition of engineering, or engineer and professional engineer, but the definition of engineering practice is what the legislature changed. Is that correct?
Yes.
The other item.
Yeah. I would definitely agree with that.
So I think it's not just about who can call themselves an engineer, is what constitutes practicing engineering. If possible, I'd like to add that to the bill. Look, we're going to make the definition of engineer and professional engineer match NCES. We are also going to revise the engineering practice definition to NCES for consistency.
Pull that up. Alejandro, do you know, is the most current version of that, do you have a date on the most current model law? I'm looking at April. That's probably not.
That might be. I mean, the model law doesn't change as often.
I have a 2021 copy. That sound about right, 2021?
That sounds right.
Revised September 2021.
That's it. Yep. And I just sent a link to it. Mike, I think you found it already.
Okay, I've got that.
So is this it up here on the screen?
Oh, yep.
I think, although with Alejandro's point about the NCWS model law stuff, at some point we're all going to be there anyways. Even the survey definition in there should, you know, would be, I think, applicable to move to that national model. I don't like all of it, but that's okay. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in there too, so.
Yeah.
And it creates that uniformity because it's, like we talked about.
Kurt, does that make sense? Just saying we're going to model law for engineering and surveying definitions for consistency and then revise the definitions. And then I would also, again, revise the definition of engineering practice.
Yes, it makes sense. This practice of engineering here under number 5.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that's excellent points, and we definitely need NCWS to support any legislation.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. My question would be, can you take the model law and just reference the model law? Do you have to write the model law into your definitions?
Yes. I don't want to. That would be so massive to just say we completely adopt that.
If the model law changes later, then we would be changing with it.
Mm.
Maybe involuntarily, so yeah.
Actually, when you put that in, when you do a reference into the rule, this is Jeannie, you have to say that you're not going to take any subsequent revisions, so you're stuck with the one that's there until you change your rule.
And that's where we are right now with land surveyors and home inspectors, so that's a problem.
With the standards, that is.
Yeah, just by adopting just the, yeah. So I would rather put it into our own law, at least right now.
It should be fairly.
Yeah, I think Judith, what you're talking about is the minimum standards. That's the issue that we have. We have minimum standards that are 20 years out of date and can't do anything with them. So.
Right. And when you look at the Lancervere, you know, the website, and it says, you know, you guys have two versions posted and you have to keep the one that's out of date and 20 years old because of us, because the board can't adopt the newer version because we can't get a rule package open. That's a mess.
That's another conversation that needs to come back around and look at those again to see a better way to move forward with the, everything that they put into it.
Well, a lot of changes coming up in the government here locally, so we'll see. Maybe we'll get a rule package open this next year.
And while we're on the path of model law, we should look at CLARB. They've got a definition for model law there. I don't know about.
Yes,
ASBOG.
Peter, is there a national home inspection
model law? No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, you probably.
ASHI was the reference for many, many years before we started certifying. Only ASHI, and then ACHI and NAHI. But the associations were the ones. That, same with pools. It's the pool associations that make rules.
The only changes that I had proposed in this was for home inspectors and alarm agents was that they had certified placed before them, because we wanted to. One of the things that our statutes doesn't do, it does it for engineers, where there's engineer and professional engineer are different definitions. None of the other occupations or professions have that distinguish the two different ones. One telling you what an engineer does and what a professional engineer is, but we know what a home inspector is, but they need to be indicated they're certified with us. And I think it's important to have that distinction for all of the occupations, professions in our statutes. I don't know if you feel the same way, but it's kind of odd that engineers have that, but nobody else does currently. So it doesn't work.
But Kurt, I think that distinction in engineering came about in large part because of the Oregon case, where somebody was calling themselves an engineer without, because they went to school for engineering, they weren't a professional engineer. So I think, you know, the world has shifted, and I'm okay with it. I mean, we're regulating the practice of professional engineering and, you know, protecting the title of professional engineering, not necessarily the word engineer. You know, there's train engineers, fire engine engineers, sort of the way the world is.
Well, kind of a follow-up question from me then is, do we need to have a definition of engineer or do we need to add the titles as I had placed them in here for certified home inspector, or should it just stay as home inspector? What's the path that you're thinking?
Well, it doesn't hold up to Dr. Angel's reasoning there as far as professional engineers go, because engineer could be a trained engineer, but there isn't any other home inspector type of thing like that. There's no trained home inspectors, you know. There's no fire home inspectors. So either way, if you want to call it certified, but can somebody thus call themselves a home inspector then, not a certified home inspector, and would we have jurisdiction over the work that he does?
I think that's a really good point, because if we start to kind of add on to the title, then it opens the door. Potentially, I'm just playing devil's advocate here. If you're the certified home inspector, I could go, well, I'm not certified, but I can do home inspections. And then suddenly, I think it muddies the water.
It may muddy the water. I'm in agreement with that.
The way that I was portraying is that we would have the two definitions, of course. There'd be the home inspector that would indicate the kind of the practice of home inspection, and then the certified indicating that they're certified with us. That's the distinction.
Because using architect, everybody's a software architect now, mm-hmm. or they refer to the bad guy across the pond as the architect of the invasion. You know, I mean,
yeah. Or the golf course architect.
Or we have golf course architects. Yeah, but they're just kind of landscape architects.
Not necessarily. Sorry, by definition.
No, but I think, you know, having registered architect or registered professional architect or something like that, mm-hmm. makes sense. It does. Then it distinguishes, because there have been court cases across the country where people have tried to say you can't use the term software architect. They go nowhere.
So you've got architects that could be anywhere, you got engineers that can be anywhere, but you still don't have home inspectors that can be anywhere. So I'm not sure whether it would be good or bad.
My suggestion is let's not change it unless we've seen a problem. And I think it's come up in engineering and in architecture. So
and surveyors. Isn't it a political poll or survey? You know? So everybody's got the problem but home inspectors.
And maybe alarm agents.
Maybe alarm agents. Of course, alarm has got a lot of meanings in itself, too. More discussion on it?
I guess I'm looking for more direction, I suppose. Because I think the distinction is that obviously there's software engineers and there's all these types of engineers, all these types of architects that can be used in such a way. How is there a better way to make it known in our statutes that this is the protected group, this is the jurisdiction is over? Or does it already do that and I'm just thinking it, overthinking it?
I think it already does that. I don't... When cases have come before the board in the past where someone is allegedly practicing architecture and they may have, you know, architectural design in their title, their company title, or, you know, they've implied that they're an architect but they're not, it's pretty clear because those cases deal with the built environment. And that's how I've always been able to kind of segregate this in my head is the locomotive engineer versus the professional engineer, is it dealing with the built environment? And I think that's how that's how these definitions tend to read, is they look at, and is there a threat to the public health, safety, and welfare in what this person is calling them an architect is? Maybe a software architect there might be, but we don't regulate them, but it's pretty clear that they're doing software. Mm-hmm. So I think...
Yeah,
go ahead.
All right. to Kurt, I was going to say, Kurt, to your question about do we need a definition for engineer that's not a professional engineer, maybe not. I mean, we really are concerned about professional engineer, so we could just take the NC as definition for professional engineer. And then, really where the rubber meets the road is practice, mm-hmm. And that's why I want to make sure that that's consistent with NCES, because we're saying... engineering can only be where it concerns the public and where it can affect the public, it can only be practiced by a professional engineer. You can call yourself an engineer all day, and the board has no issue with it, as long as you're not practicing engineering in a way that affects the public. That's it.
And even in the construction industry, it gets a little bit confusing because we have project engineers, contractors call their people who are involved in the construction of a project, they may call them a project engineer. Mm-hmm. Some mm-hmm. of them are PEs. I've worked with a lot of them that are, but some aren't. But they're not
right.
Technically practicing engineering. They're not really holding themselves out to be a regulated professional engineer. So I think we're okay. That's where my argument for built environment falls apart a little bit. But.
And back to home inspectors, we've defined home inspection. And we've also said that you cannot do a home inspection without certification. So I don't see the need to put certified in front of the home inspector's name. I think you're covered in just the definition of home inspector and home inspection combined.
I have up on the board the current, you know, number 10 of the definitions is engineer. And so I would say mm-hmm. that from this discussion that we would remove engineer and keep professional engineer using the model law.
I'm good with that. With removing engineer, keeping professional engineer, and updating engineering practice. Yeah.
Would that have to be professional engineering practice?
No, I think engineering practice, we're just saying it's done by a professional engineer as defined in 32.122.01, which reads. I think that's fine.
Okay, let's go down to professional engineering the Northern Register that I throw in front of it.
Mr. Chair, there was also discussion in the packet about the engineering branches. Mm-hmm. Is this an appropriate time to talk about that, or do we want to talk about definitions, other stuff still?
You know, my concern with the branches, which is something I very much would like to talk about, but is that we haven't had the opportunity to do research yet to find out if we were to make that change and not be branch specific with the disciplines, what kind of impact that might have on other, you know, governmental agencies, municipalities, cities, things like that, that have specific language requiring specific engineering. I don't know. I'm a little bit worried about that. That as much as I want to think about that, I'm not sure.
I tend to agree with you, Judith, that this is. It's a good idea to look into it, but I don't know that it's ready to be put on a bill without the research, because it could backfire.
Right.
Things I would think of is exactly what you said. What do local city, county statutes or rules say about engineering? Also, a question. I know we have at least a couple of disciplines or branches like geological and sanitary that have no NCES exam. So we need to think, how are we licensing these folks going forward? Most of those have very few people in them. So is it cost-effective to have a branch for, you know, sanitary engineering? Is it cost-effective to have petroleum engineers? Or should we realign them with another branch? But again, that's also a longer question than figuring it out over the next month.
Yep. I don't know what else to say. It's something I really do want to tackle, but I think the legwork behind that is going to be a lot. And
I think you almost need a working group where you pull people from most of those branches and get them together to figure out what they'd like to do.
Agreed. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that, Kurt?
I mean, that's why it wasn't included, that discussion, because we just got to figure that it would. It's not something that can be pushed through quickly.
It's just too much. Yeah.
It's too much to take on at this point.
Yeah, and I'd like to know statistics on how many states, even if they're not discipline-specific, they still have a designation for structural engineers. You know, the professional engineer and a designation for structural engineer. Because I think there's a fair...
And to be honest, I'd like seeing electrical engineers when you need electrical, and, you know, mechanical, you need a mechanical instead of just engineer. So,
well, I do too. It's just that if you're asking me personally, I like the way it is, but we're definitely out of line with the rest of the nation, because there's only a few jurisdictions that have this very discipline specific model that Arizona has. And so maybe, well, I don't know, even if we got the comedy and reciprocity done, it still might be a problem, because most people are coming from another state to be licensed here that are licensed as a PE, as a professional engineer, not specific, but then they come here and our laws require very specific. Help me out here, Julie. What do you see as the problem there? Because
that's exactly it. They're coming as a professional engineer and then they come here and branch.
They have to specify what branch. You know, they're not coming here to be a professional engineer. They're coming here to be a professional electrical engineer or civil engineer, right, or whatever. And then they've got to show all the accompanying everything to support that, including experience and all.
So why is that a problem? I mean, wouldn't we look at their experience and see if it lines up with that discipline? And then if we get an exam record from NCES, we know which exam they took, unless it was 30 years ago.
But no, because NCWS doesn't even have records of the exam they took generally.
From those states.
From those states. Yeah, because they don't keep track of it, and the states don't keep track of it. So if they're coming, again, as a professional, I'm just going to say Iowa or Ohio or something.
Indiana.
I mean, they're like, we don't know. Nobody has a record.
The state might not know, but I'm 99% sure NCES knows which exam they took.
From what we've
seen, the letter they sent you says which exam you took.
Just from what from what I've seen on the NCES records, it'll say PE exam unknown, or and then I've asked NCES and they don't have record of it. So those actually currently are going before the board, like, hey, they did take the PE exam, but we don't know what.
Yeah. So we have that special place on our agenda, exam unknown.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Have we asked NCES about what information they can provide? You know, this issue in particular. We're not the only state. I mean, I know you said only a few, but a lot of the states I'm registered in have those designations. Washington, California, other places. A lot of the western states have it.
I was going to say, a number of years ago, we were seeing a humongous influx of verifications from NCES asking us for exam information when they had moved to a new database. And that may be key to it as well, is that they might have lost a lot of data when they did that transition.
They did lose a lot of data. Yeah. I think that.
Was that done by an IT engineer?
software architect.
Yeah, it's definitely been problematic. So,
well, at the very least, we can check the experience record and see which branch their experience is in, right?
We can do that, yes. Yeah. I guess my understanding of the endorsement is that they met those requirements of being licensed somewhere else for, the 5 years, and that it would be an automatic.
It wouldn't be a whoosh through anymore. Right. It would be like, now we got to look at your experience. You might as well just go on the normal route.
Yeah. Right.
Anyway, I understand the challenge. In my mind, that's not reason enough to do away with branches, because there's a benefit on having the right professional on a job. So it's definitely an issue, but not, I wouldn't think it's a reason to get rid of branches. I think there's a case to be made to streamline branches so we don't have 20, and to make sure we know how we license them.
Yeah, I did do research on that. I did a comparison as I was preparing for this meeting and kept it out, but there are definitely two branches. It was the sanitation and geological.
Geophysical.
Is it geophysical? Mm-hmm. That NC.
Geological, sanitary don't have exams, I don't think.
Yeah, so, and then we have, what branches do we have? We have those two branches. And NC's is a couple of exams that we don't have branches for as well.
Right.
So it doesn't jive.
So one way or the other, we need to revisit that. Maybe
at a minimum, we should align our list of specialties, or however you want to do it, or branches, with the NC's list, so that at least we're paired up with the exams.
And that could be a rule. It's in rule all the different branches, so then we can
do
it there as well.
Yeah.
So you have to
coordinate
yeah.
all of that.
Good idea.
But I agree. I think to eliminate the branches from rules or statutes would be problematic for municipalities. I mean, there are plan reviewers that there, some of them actually do look for the seal and make sure we've got the right discipline doing the right work. And mm-hmm. so I think that's important to retain that.
Okay.
Well, future discussion on what we retain and mm-hmm. streamline and make it more easier for the.
Yeah.
The people from state to state.
So I feel like I have a roadmap as to professional definitions that you guys want from the model laws. That would be from NCARV and CLARV for the architects, landscape architects, and then from NC's is going to be land surveyor and engineer.
Yep.
Would that be correct in saying that?
Okay. And see if
ASBOG
has anything.
Okay. The other things under these definitions of 101 that we have proposed is moving like the strain geologist, as you see, from exemptions, because it's telling you what a strain geologist is, thereby defining it. So I thought it was best to put it under definitions.
I agree.
So.
Yep, all of those look good.
Yep, that's great.
We, of course, don't really understand where this is actually used elsewhere. I think I need to do some more research, because obviously, when they were trying to get rid of geologists a number of years ago, and it didn't happen that way, this was put in there. And we don't know where else it's
being used
in statute or jurisdictions.
Do you know that, Doug? Is it being used under mining or anything?
Not that I'm aware of. In other states you're talking about?
No, here.
Here.
It already exists. It's
mining geologists don't need registration, right? So they're excluded.
I mean, I don't know what the purpose was. I mean, I know the legislature was trying to get rid of geologists
right.
altogether, so they came up with this strange thing.
Yeah.
But is there some purpose behind it that I don't know of? Like, oh, we're the only state that has the mine inspector that's appointed instead of
that's correct. Job description
right?
says you can be a trained geologist.
So,
what jobs are those?
Yeah. Was there a reason back
then? I'm not a big fan of this. I just think it's confusion.
I don't think anybody's a big fan of it here.
Yeah. So from my perspective.
You know, I think there was, because originally that bill wasn't just about geologists. They also included landscape architects.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. So I think it was just a general deregulation push. It wasn't given just to geologists. It's that's the one that they ended up being able to do.
So maybe not some unknown ulterior motive that I don't know about, but just some kind of
politics
way for the legislature to feel like that was a win on their part or
yes,
something?
It was a deregulation effort.
Mm.
Is there any way to gather statistics? Who's using this title? I mean,
I actually had a call from someone from Texas last week who's a geologist asking me about it because he says that my understanding of reading this is that I don't have to seal anything. I can just come over there and do work. Can you tell me that? And I'm like, I can't answer these questions. I'm not a lawyer.
It's a state,
sorry.
The state statute requires a geologist to seal certain documents, right?
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't say a trained geologist can do that. In the statute, it says a professional registered geologist.
So I wonder at some point if we could try to just exit that back out.
That was the reason for my question.
I would love to have that taken
if
out
we,
because I really do think it's confusing.
If we could have, it would be good to have any background or not background, I don't know, information on the fact that nobody's using this. And to our knowledge, we can't find any agency or anything that would use it. It would certainly make it easier to say nobody's using it.
You have to go through the rules.
Well, we don't license the trained geologist, right?
No.
Right.
There's no license for that.
We don't
have
licensing.
So.
Right.
No.
But my problem is the statutes require professional registered geologists. So what is this person even allowed to do? I don't even know.
Well,
that's
this
my
is it right
here.
The very top, this is the current language of making
a
geologist
without
being registered.
Okay, well, you know, a mining geologist, I guess, would fall into that, I suppose. But
and that's above in the exemptions.
Mining geologist doesn't need a license or doesn't need to call himself a trained geologist either, right? They can just, anyone working in mining can do what they want with that.
They're exempt.
So if we can just maybe have our solid rationale, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could try. If you feel like it's something we should do, we could go to the board.
But devil's advocate, this might be, again, a poison pill where the legislature says, oh, you're trying to undo what we've done.
Yeah.
No, and then they start looking at the bill in way more detail than they need to. When it really hasn't been an issue, right? They don't have practice protections. All they have is a title protection. They can call themselves that, and nobody likes to call themselves trained something.
No kidding. I've never even seen the term used anywhere by anybody.
Well,
no.
I mean, we can just leave it sit, and then I don't know. Maybe again at some point, a few years down the road, say, "Well, it's been in there 12 years, and to our knowledge, we don't know anybody that's ever utilized it."
It's a useless piece of
wording
in this.
Well, what's really interesting about it is, okay, we describe the training and education requirements to call yourself a trained geologist, but if I go out and call myself a trained geologist, who's going to stop me?
Right.
Where's the enforcement authority
there's none.
For the term?
Yeah, there's none.
I was talking to this gentleman from Texas, and on my own, looking out at this, if somebody put a complaint against them for doing geology work, and he can say, well, I'm a trained geologist, I would think that we would have to go through this list. Okay, have you been convicted of a felony? Are any of these things that would somehow prevent, you know, that term from being used by that person? Because it gives you this big laundry list underneath it, you know.
but they're all things that would keep me as an architect from being able to call myself an architect if any of this kind of stuff happened to
him. If any of these get checked off, you're no longer a trained geologist because you were under this list. Now you're practicing as a professional geologist and in violation of our laws.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I can even think of how this would be regulated.
Yeah, but if they don't have any of this, we can't stop them.
Right.
We have no authority to say, you can't call yourself a trained geologist. They go, okay, prove it. And we can't.
Let me give you an example where this could be a problem. Is the governor passed that $1 billion water fund, right? I'm getting calls every week from people all over the country wanting to know how they can come into the state and do projects and take some of this money. Okay, so I can totally see somebody saying, well, I'm a trained geologist. I can apply this for this WIFA fund and do the work here. But that's not a good idea.
Great. Anyway, I would say let's
make some sense.
Not poke the bear at this point. Let's leave it. And then down the road.
I'm okay with that, too.
I would rather not have it as Kurt said, or maybe it was Alejandro said, have it derail the rest of what could be a really good bill.
Yeah. It seems like it could be great for sunset reviews. Hey, look, we tried this. It hasn't done anything good or bad. How about we get rid of it at that point?
Yeah.
And speaking of that, when is sunset review of the board?
I would have to verify, but I want to say it starts in 23.
I think it's fairly soon.
Yeah.
It's just coming up.
Yeah,
because we went through one while you were on the board.
Yeah.
I've gone through two.
That.
From my understanding, the last sunset audit was not a full-blown audit. You can have self-audits or where they're for like a year and a half. With you going through everything, which I would expect
that's probably what will happen
this time. And ADOT's going through their sunset review this year.
It takes a long time.
It's an arduous process.
Yep.
So shall we go on to our ability to investigate or authority to investigate?
Hey, Mr. Chairman, one more thing on the definitions real quick, and it's more of a process than a change. It's the moving the mining exemption from the definitions to the exemptions, which I think is a good idea.
Yep.
Just make sure we touch base with the mining industry because this will get them riled up if they don't understand what we're doing.
Because we're not.
They want to make sure that exemption is clear in statute.
We're not changing anything. We're just trying to clarify it and get it into the right location. So that probably wouldn't hurt.
It's just so clunky in the definitions.
Yeah.
So where is it?
It's written in six different places. So I think we just want to tell them, look, wait.
We're moving it to
We want to put it in one place where everyone can find it, but it's still there with the same language.
Yeah.
So this would be under exemptions, right underneath the industrial and communication common area.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Question?
Yes.
I know we briefly brought up the land surveying definitions in this. Do we want to go with that, with the combined, like we talked about, with the engineering definitions from NCWES?
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, the two are compatible, so I think if you're going to change one, you should probably change them both.
Yes, I would agree.
Is we're the two most closely related fields in about 85% of what we do. So,
good
point, Mike. Thank you.
My plan is to take these model laws, get the language, put it in here, and then if we have another future meeting to present it to you again. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay.
So you're looking for a quick meeting, another quick meeting, because you guys are under.
You guys have the time.
No, I don't mean the duration of the meeting. I mean coming up soon.
Yeah,
right?
We'd have to get it scheduled pretty quickly.
Yeah, I want to make sure that whatever staff does, that you guys have your eyes on it, or there's some mechanism that it's not just staff presenting it to the board. The L&R is okay to everything, and if that has to be
And Ed will come, and he said,
"Sure, you bet."
As the chair,
I can do that. Yeah. No, depends on the date.
You just got Mullen told. We'll try to coordinate well
we
with
go.
You.
Yeah. Well, if it's would we be looking at the October meeting?
It's September the 4th, Tuesday in September, and the next one is November 1st.
Okay. Oh, so we don't have an October meeting.
Because the ASBUG meeting is right there. So,
okay.
And there's five Tuesdays in November, so I just stretched it just a tiny bit.
Well, so you pushed it early November then.
The first, like literally the first. I think.
Because that
sure.
I know can work. When's the October meeting?
Let's see. No October. So September.
Oh, that's right. September
27th.
The 27th. That's the 27th because I already have that down on my agenda for something else.
Oh.
With you guys.
Oh, okay, good. So it must be the meeting. So then the next one is Tuesday, November 1st.
Let me just look here. Yeah, because those meetings start at 9.
Yep. We do have a minute.
Yes, let's do a 5-minute break. Yeah, I have a call till 9:30, but then I'm ready. So I could do it
that's
here.
That's perfect.
Just edit it.
Oh, yeah. We'll always make space for you.
Did I hear we're taking a 5-minute break?
We're taking a 5-minute break.
5-minute break.
Awesome. Thank you.
I'll put this phone on mute.
Hey, we are now recording again.
Right. We're back in session. And we're unmuted. Good. All right.
Maybe a roll call.
A roll call, please.
Mr. Marley?
Here.
Mr. Brady?
Here.
Mr. Bartlett?
Here.
Mr. Stanley? Dr. Angel?
Here.
Mr. Fondren?
Here.
Mr. Leeds?
Here.
Hey, we have a quorum.
Back in business. Thank you. I lost track of where I left off.
Where are we, Kurt?
So I think it sounded like we were done with definitions.
Yes.
Part of this package was additional changes 1 to 126. So from this opinion that came out, Supreme Court basically was saying there's no mechanism for a respondent to make the board go to a hearing or take an action. And so 32.106.02 is what gives the board the authority to open investigations and complaints against unregistered practice of our professions and occupations.
Right.
So the language that you see here, it was initially, I took it from the pharmacy board, and then Judith and I tweaked it further. Pharmacy board being one of the boards that the Supreme Court had pointed out in its opinion that did have a mechanism to do this. And so this is what we're showing you is basically changing this to be very specific that the board is allowed to open these types of investigations, that the violations that this falls under is under 32.145, which we'll get to later, and then below that the board can seek informal resolution of these, and if the respondent refuses to participate or wants to go to hearing, that it should occur once requested.
Which is just funny, really, to me, I know, because it's always been that way. There's not a time when it wouldn't have been that way had somebody requested it. But we didn't have it in black and white. So this is it in black and white,
okay. Saying
if somebody wants to go to hearing, the board shall hold a hearing pursuant to.
Is everybody on the committee familiar with why this topic is actually on the agenda? And if not, is it appropriate that we kind of talk a little bit about it just to give them the background?
Well,
a lot of us are familiar, but
Yes, Dr. Angel.
I don't know if it's appropriate to speak about the specific litigation, right? But I think it's definitely appropriate to understand what the Supreme Court has said the board needs to do, if that's what you mean.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
I mean, so basically what Kurt summed up is really it, because this was directly referenced in the ruling from the Supreme Court on a case that's still basically in progress to a degree. I mean, it is. So we're trying to be proactively compliant with their suggestion or recommendation, something like that. And I really like the language. I mean, I like how that reads. I think it covers exactly what they're saying that we needed to have in our statute. And
so my understanding is if the respondent refuses to respond, then the board will go to a hearing?
No, I mean, it doesn't, not necessarily, but it doesn't change the process the way it's really always been in place with allowing the board to resolve things in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
But in this unique situation that we found ourselves in at this time, where the board never issued a final order, and then a lawsuit came in, and then the Supreme Court felt like the issue with this individual was ripe in the sense that he didn't have a mechanism to compel the board to go through with a hearing and give an opinion or have an opinion issued, that was a problem, and that we needed to correct that.
They feel like the respondent's basically being kept in limbo, and could be kept in limbo, you know, forever by the board.
And this would allow him to come out of that. No.
Okay.
I mean, you know.
So if the respondent refuses to do it voluntarily, to participate in the informal process, or refuses to resolve the matter informally, or requests a hearing, the board shall hold a hearing. But how does that push the board into making a hearing?
Because it's giving the respondent the ability to request that the board hold a hearing.
They could have done that anyway,
but this is it in black and white
right
there.
Okay, so, but if he doesn't make that request, does it still stay in limbo?
No, this is saying, so what happened in this case, without going anything too deep, is that the individual did not participate, did not participate
mm-hmm.
at all. And so this mechanism would say, you know, usually our mechanism is, here's a consent agreement. Don't sign in 30 days, we're going to hearing. So, but this is more, again, black and white, because we have to make that motion at every board meeting that there's after 30 days we'll go to hearing. If we don't make that motion, then it gets messed up and Scott's mad at us or an attorney.
Yes.
Okay.
And this basically says if you're just hands off the entire way through, we have to take it to hearing.
All right. I understand that.
I think that's very good. Thanks for clarifying, because that was kind of where Peter was at. It was a little unclear, but now I understand it. Mm-hmm. Basically, any of those three things happens or don't happen, it goes to hearing.
Right.
It's really that, I don't want to nitpick on this, but it's really if allowing the individual, if you see where it says, or requests a hearing,
mm-hmm.
the board shall.
Right.
So.
I like it. I mean, I think obviously there's always the option if the board feels that we shouldn't proceed or should do something else, we can always dismiss, close, do something else. It's not precluding that.
Yep.
Yes.
And then I also like the more general wording in this first option, Judith and Chris, where it says seek to resolve the matter through informal means. I think that includes the cease and desist letter. It includes consent agreements, anything you want to do. So I like the broader language better.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like that as well. The under or, how do those fit into this? Because
this was only because I know other boards have the ability to do a cease and desist. I'm not pushing it in any way. It's just letting you know that also exists out there in other boards.
I think that's important language to include somewhere. I just I I saw dismiss the complaint if the complaint was without merit. I think that's great to have in there. But then it says or, and then it says send or delegate for a cease and desist. I'm not sure how that, we need to figure out how that fits in, but I think it's important that we have that in
the toolbox. And I think, am I misinterpreting it? I think they're suggesting, and Kurt, are you suggesting that it's the language above the or we use the language below the or, not that we implement both, right?
Correct.
Well, I...
Okay.
So it's a 1 and 2 above, 4, so, 1, 2, and 3 below.
So I'm thinking back to a series of cases when I was on the board, and Alejandro and I think even Leroy mm-hmm. were there. We had a land surveyor that had 11 open cases at one time
that were all
in the
is.
Hearing, and we had no cease and desist authority, and so he just kept doing his thing and racking up violations. And I think, I don't know, if we can somehow keep what we're doing up here in one and two and then add on somehow, I don't know how you word it, I'm just suggesting that somehow we need cease and desist authority. A lot of boards have that. We don't, and I think we're missing that.
Okay. I know the governor's office does ask us on an annual basis how many ceases and desists. We obviously, since we don't have that power, ours is always zero.
Yeah.
But that is something they are curious about and want to be informed of every time we send out.
Yeah.
Ed, are you saying, I mean, I think it's basically there. And I get your point now, and I recall the conversation, but I think cease and desist is a good idea. So is it basically just implementing the language below, you know, the or? What the statute will say is that we can investigate. If there's a violation, we can, the board may do a cease and desist, resolve informally, or move to hearing, or dismiss. But, you know, so it'll be all that language seems to make sense. Is there anything missing?
Can you scroll back down a little bit, Kurt? Is there anything missing from the top that's not in the bottom?
It shouldn't be. It should be mirror, except for the number one added.
So we're basically looking to remove the one and two that are above the or and instead doing the other stuff, right?
Yeah,
okay, now I understand. Sorry.
No, no.
I'm getting it now.
So if there's nothing missing from up above.
That, it makes it easier to see it.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. So I would take the or.
Yeah. We're good.
Yeah.
Okay. So you like cease and desist?
I do.
Okay. I don't have any experience with that entails. Judith, did you ever have those in the fund board?
I did not have to issue those. I mean, we had it, but I didn't use it.
Okay, so yes.
The way I read this is it still requires board action. You just can delegate the sending of the letter. So.
Well, not according to this.
Well, the board may. So the board would have to send it, or they would have to delegate to Judith to send
right.
it.
Basically, so that means either the board chair signs it or they delegate me to this thing. Yeah.
But what promulgates the cease and desist is a board action.
That's
which
fact.
I think it should be.
Yeah. Yes, most certainly.
I just want to make sure that we make that really clear so that it's not, you know, not Judith.
Making
just,
me power crazy?
I don't see that happening, but.
but also solely responsible.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. It's the board. I am a servant of the board.
Okay. No, I think we're good.
I like it.
This is Deanie. Can I mention something here?
Please, Deanie.
Yes, please.
You should also include that you could refer it to another agency for action, like, for instance, submit it to a prosecutorial agency for criminal charges.
That's brilliant. Is there language from another agency that you like?
There's some... Deanie, this is Ed Morley. I think there's something in our statutes that allow us to do that already, because I remember we had a case where a developer was basically taking one soils report, copying the cover sheet, changing the name of changing the lot number, and did this, and so ended up getting assessed a pretty hefty
civil penalty, but also was referred to your office for criminal prosecution.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing that in the statutes. Does anybody else remember it?
I don't know either. I think it'd be good to have it here along with everything else to make sure it's, you know, I don't think it hurt. And
Well, I don't know, but I think maybe I would leave it a little more vague, like refer to another agency for
additional or concurrent action.
I think
for supplemental action as opposed to,
It may not be critical. Let's say you refer to the Attorney General's Office for Consumer Fraud Complaint. You know, something like that. That's not necessarily criminal, so I would say maybe refer to another agency for appropriate action or something like that. I don't know.
I like that because there have been times when we've overseen a case and it's an architect that's also a builder and they've messed up on both ends, and so we've referred over to the Registrar of Contractors in addition to our board taking action.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that if you could make that clear, I know we did that. I think the case that you might have been talking about was Mr. Padilla.
Yep.
and in fact, we have referred his cases now for criminal, or we are in the process of doing that, hopefully, referring those cases over for criminal prosecution.
Okay.
And it would be good to know that you have that clear direction to be able to do that. You need a semicolon and an or in there.
Okay.
Correct.
I like that.
Or a period or whatever you're doing there. Are these ors, so maybe ought to be all semicolons and or. You see what I'm saying? Like you could do this or you could do, now I'll put the or at the end.
Okay. I know what you mean.
You understand what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And
Ledge Council probably.
Yes, that just needs because you've got two sentences in two, so that you might want to make those sentences that starts with if respondent refuses to participate, yada, you make that three, and then four, and then or. Yeah, you got it.
Thank you, Jeannie. That looks better. It does.
I'm not long enough to say something. I'm just too, I have too much humor. Verbal diarrhea.
And I could start number three with the board or hold a hearing pursuant to blah, blah, blah. If
I could. Or the board shall. If you're going to make it mandatory, the board shall.
You could just move that into that sentence up. The board shall hold a hearing pursuant to blah, blah, blah. If the respondent refuses to participate in the investigative process, refuses to show up, or. Requests a hearing.
Working on it.
Sounds good. Anything else on this one?
You have to take the May out from above.
Yeah.
Well, that would indicate that we have to do all of these, or just or.
Mm. Well, you can't have a may and a shall in the same rule.
Okay. Hold on a minute. We still need work on three. If the board shall, or, oh, okay, the board may. The board may. Wow, that is a problem.
So if we just say the board, colon, and then under number one and two, just say may send, may seek, and then number three,
shall.
Yeah. Because that's shall if it's requested, basically, you know. May refer, may dismiss. That works, right?
Yes.
Yep. Just need to make a space between four and five and you're good.
Deanie, I wish you could see Kurt and the little tiny desk he's working on.
No, being a scrivener for this type of thing is not easy. I know I've done it.
I think this is good.
Hit your backspace. You got one too many lines in there.
It's gonna.
Yeah. Oh, I see it.
Well, we'll work on it.
I'll work on it, don't worry. They'll just frustrate
you. That works.
Yeah.
Close enough.
Whatever.
Okay, any other comments?
Negative.
Nope.
Okay, so I want to skip to 145 now because the top of this, one that we just worked on, committed a violation of this chapter as defined under section 32.145. So these two need a jive. Mm-hmm. So let's go down to 145. Okay. Initially, in the language of this, we had any person who commits any of the following acts knowingly. After talking to Scott Donald, he said, Kurt, people get out of these things all the time using that knowingly. So I removed that.
Okay.
So now we've added with the intent to defraud or mislead, which narrows the scope considerably, and I don't know if you guys want that or not. And does that also give too much wiggle room out of violations?
You want to hear my opinion on this?
Of course.
Yes.
Absolutely.
I mean, knowingly is less hard to prove than with the intent to. With the intent to is what we call specific intent. Mm-hmm. It means you have to prove an element of specific intent, that they actually had the specific intent to defraud or mislead. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, I don't know what it read before, but apparently before it was a strict liability violation.
I agree 100%. Intent, we'll never be able to prove intent.
Okay. Anyone else have an opinion?
So, Deanie, are you saying go back to knowingly or just take that out? Any person who commits any of the following acts is guilty of a Class 2 misdemeanor? I mean, do we have to have any of that with intent or knowingly?
I think you could theoretically make it a strict liability offense, which means if you do it, you're guilty. But if you, let's see, let me just take a look at it for a second.
So without divulging too much, we had a case that went to the administrative law judge where someone offered to practice in the state of Arizona and blamed it on an office person for sending out the email, and I think there was no intent to defraud. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it was your case because I I was your witness. but I think my interpretation of that would be there was no intent to defraud, but he offered to practice.
He did it.
He offered to practice architecture.
Yeah, I kind of like the strict liability thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way a lot of things are written. If you look at other agencies who have these statutes, and it would be beneficial to do that, to look at, say, for instance, another agency that says if you do the following things, it can be a Class 2 misdemeanor. They don't have that in there. They don't have it. It would make sense for us to look at some comparisons. And if you want, I can look some up right now. But I don't think you need a state of mind. I don't think you can just make it strict liability.
Deanie, I have done research, too, and I actually grabbed some of this language from pharmacy. Pharmacy actually has a distinction where they have, this is what a Class 2 misdemeanor is, and this is what a Class, I think it's like Class 3 felony, or it rises to felony if it was knowing and with the intent to defraud or mislead.
That makes sense mm-hmm. because if you're trying to prove fraud, you do need intent. But you're not doing that here. You're basically, these are just Class 2 misdemeanors. You're just saying if you do this, we could theoretically charge you with a Class 2 misdemeanor. Let's talk about Mr. Padilla. Mr. Padilla was charged with a Class 2 misdemeanor in Pinal County for practicing and not being registered. That made it simple for Pinal County to charge him with a Class 2 misdemeanor. So, I don't know that for the purposes of a misdemeanor, you need any kind of state of mind. Strict liability.
I agree, and I think it's easier to back off if someone really did it without intending to. We can simply decide not to prosecute or whatever if we think there's genuine issues.
Dr. Angel, you don't use this very often.
Yeah.
It's not used very often. I mean, I only know, I haven't been with you guys that long, but I only know the one. So, you know, we would have made it really difficult for Pinal County to charge that misdemeanor against Mr. Padilla if we had that mental state put in there.
So, so I'm just gonna, if you want to look at 32-1996, I think that's where Kurt got, or I think that's the reference from pharmacy.
It's possible.
Yeah, let's look up something else.
Okay.
But I thought that a pharmacy statute also increased the level of the misdemeanor or felony, but I think if it's just a class 2 misdemeanor, why do we need intent?
Well, why don't we just take out with the intent and have it following acts to defraud or mislead? And then you don't have to worry
where?
About...
32-1996.
I don't want to look at that because that's pharmacy. I want to look at something that's a little more directly relevant. But first let me ask you, where was knowingly before? I don't see...
Well, we don't currently have knowingly in there. Like, knowingly,
it's just removing, right?
We did not have knowingly.
So the original text was any person who commits any of the following acts is guilty of a class 2 misdemeanor.
Okay, and then Scott asked you to put knowingly in there?
No, I had knowingly as part of the draft, and he says take that out.
Take it out.
Oh, I'm telling you the same thing.
Wait, so why do we need to change this? I mean,
we don't need to change. That's what I'm about.
Background. Let me tell you guys some background.
Okay.
Part of the opinion from the Supreme Court is that basically the consent agreements offered to this individual, if he had signed them, he could possibly go to jail because a misdemeanor, a class 2 misdemeanor, can send you to jail. And that was their concern. This says that he was guilty of that and therefore could go to jail by signing this form. Therefore, kind of holding it over his head.
So,
yeah, but there's a law that says that when you make an admission in an administrative case, it's not in a consent decree. It can't be used. So I don't understand that ruling.
That's a question for them.
okay. Well, yeah.
It seems like it might help with maybe in a very rare instance, but I think it hurt us in a lot of instances to have to prove state of mind. So I'd leave it the way it is.
Okay. And I'm fine with that. It was just, I don't want to go into it even further, but I know just discussions with our counsel has made us look at this statute a bit more as well.
Is.
So, thank you.
Well, maybe what we should do with this is table it and let me and Scott talk about it. I don't want to overrule what he's saying.
No. He did not tell me to put any of that in. He told me all the issues that you just raised were exactly his same issues.
Yeah.
You guys are completely on the same page.
Maybe we could look into some more, Dini. Like, I'm looking at 32-2084 for psychology. Maybe just look at some of those and, you know, some other ones and see if there's anything that might be more.
Well, I'm just trying to find something real quickly here. Give me a moment.
Well, is there a lesser degree of offense than a class 2 misdemeanor? I mean, these are things that somebody's offered to, you know, I got an email and the guy says, hey, I'm an architect in Arizona, and I look it up on the database and I go, no, you're not. You know, and I mean, it's not, there's no imminent harm to the public. This is just yet, but there could be, and that's why you do an enforcement action. But it's not something worthy of jail time.
Yeah, and
let me point you to ARS 3-3473, which is the weights and measures section. It has to do with violations of weights and measures law. Says a person is guilty of a class 1 misdemeanor who blah, 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 and a person is guilty of a class 2 misdemeanor who blah, 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 blah.
Are those technical legal terms?
Yeah, exactly. Similar to yada, yada, yada.
Okay.
Tell me where it is again. You said Title 3, what was it?
3473.
So, are you saying, meaning that like this list that we have can be broken down further into different levels of
misdemeanors? If you look at similar statutes, they do not have a state of mind.
Okay.
Maybe there's some other nice stuff in there that you might be interested in, like knowingly interfering with or obstructing agents or inspectors, yada, yada. I mean, there's some kind of cool shit in there, but I'm not suggesting to change the list. I'm just saying, please don't put a state of mind in there. That's my thought.
So we can't even find
a...
There we go.
You can pull that up, maybe, and share it.
There we go.
Can you put it in the comments, maybe, Judith, if you found it?
Oh, yeah.
So what's the difference between class 1 and class 2?
Well, actually...
It's class 1 misdemeanor is punishable by 6 months in jail and $1,000 fine, if I remember correctly. I could be wrong about that. And then a class 2 is a $750 fine and 4 months in jail, unless it's changed. There is a class 3, which is like 30 days in jail and a $500 fine. It's all just about the punishment. It's nothing else.
Okay.
Would it be wise to just make it a misdemeanor instead of designate the class?
No, you have to designate the class.
Okay.
You have to decide how serious it is. If it's like worth more jail time, more fine, less jail time, less fine, hardly any jail time. And I mean, if there are costs, you do have to designate that.
Feeny, I have a question. When this is sent off to another agency, though, they don't specifically just follow our class 2 misdemeanor. Like if somebody did fraud, doesn't that go beyond a misdemeanor?
Well, that's a felony. So, you know, for fraud schemes, that drops it into an entirely different category. That's like a class 2, class 3 felony. That's big stuff.
Yeah.
But that's not what you're trying to do here.
No.
This is just... But there are a lot of examples of this throughout the statutes. I could probably point to about 10 of them. I don't think there's a state of mind in any of them that I've seen. Now, pharmacy may be different, but I don't think you need it.
And pharmacy includes the state of mind to prove a Class 5 felony, not to prove a misdemeanor.
Exactly. That's why it's in there.
There we go.
You find it?
Yeah. It messes up because I have the same screen. Oh my,
I picked this one because it's a little bit similar to what you do. Weights and Measures has licensing. It's professional licensing, like they have these designation as service agency representatives and stuff. They're like professional licenses. Or some of it is just about the devices, Weights and Measures of devices, but there's some useful stuff in here.
Can you slide to 2? There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know that you need to sort of sort
I think simple is better.
This is just an example of how you can do it without having a criminal state of mind. That's my point. Yeah, I mean, I'm good.
I think we're good.
Anybody else?
So, other changes that were proposed, and again, within just that. Adding in this state, I think it was important because it didn't really. I think Judith and I were having a discussion of where, you know, you're certified in some other state, and you want to put at the end of your name, hey, I'm a PE, you're a PE in Missouri, but does that mean that you can't walk around with a name badge that says PE and have your name in Arizona?
I think, Kurt, I would move in the state to after practice. Practices or offers to practice in this state, yada, 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 yada.
I think Jeannie is talking about number one.
I am.
So what the intent is I could walk around with a name badge. If I'm from New Mexico, I can walk around with a name badge that says Ed Marley, R.A., Registered Architect or something, at a conference here and not get dinged or give somebody my business card.
Which
I think makes sense. I mean, I ought to be able to say I'm an architect and not have to clarify because, you know, in nine whatever state that I'm in, or whatever.
It'd be a long name tag for you, wouldn't it?
It'd be a long name tag. There's no intent to offer services. It's just, you know, somebody says, what do you do? I'm an architect.
Could always say architect from south of the Gadsden Purchase Line.
There we go. Yes.
You got into state number two in there twice. Do you want that, Kurt?
So advertises in this state.
You need to take this out.
Which bit?
Oh, yeah.
Qualified to practice any board regulated. And then since you started with in this state, services in this state, do you need the last in this state?
Yeah, probably not.
It seems like maybe the first in the state should go out. Let's see, advertise the services using the title yada, yada, yada. That may indicate to the public that the person is certified or registered or is qualified to practice in this state, any board-regulated profession, yada, yada. So I'm thinking you need one in this state, and it would be after practice, and you could take out the first in the state. That seems like to me that would work.
That way it parallels the order in paragraph one.
Yeah.
That the person is certified or registered or is qualified to practice in this state in board-regulated professional occupation.
Kurt, why are we missing geologists there?
Me.
RG.
I was going to mention that.
Well, I was thinking about it because our current geologist said implied we're a little bit off here, complicating things, because we say registered professional geologist instead of just, right?
So instead of registered.
Instead of just registered geologist. Like everything is, you know, like.
Well, I think our proposed text also reads registered professional landscape architect.
Yeah, our
yeah.
So we want to make sure that we keep all of this parallel or you know, coordinated.
It's confusing from state to state, too.
Right.
I'm also a PG in California.
That's true, because even in Nevada, we're professional land surveyors. And boy, if you don't use that PLS, they get really upset over there. So I have to remember going back and forth. And I know some time ago, even for surveying here, we had an open discussion about, are we registered land surveyors, professional land surveyors, licensed land surveyors? Because some of the older licenses had different things on them. Mine says registered land surveyor, but we had came up with one that said licensed as a registered land surveyor, so I don't know, it gets kind of confusing. And some states are touchy about it.
Is it RPG?
No, it should be RG, because that's...
It should be RG, and I think, wasn't that what Bill was saying?
It should be.
It should be, but
in our seals section in the rules, registered professional geologist.
Oh, it does say that?
That's what he was like, that's weird, why are you doing that? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. That's what it says in the book.
Right.
So
my experience is either RG or PG. There's no mix of those.
Right.
And CLARB in probably 2016 was pushing using PLA rather than RLA. Professional Landscape Architect.
So if we try to simplify the RPG to, I mean,
you know how many stamps are out there now with RG on them?
Right.
I wouldn't want to change that.
Okay.
You have or other title, which should cover anything we don't put in there, really, right?
Bert, I think you need to move in the state to after practice, not profession. He's got it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I missed where it's supposed to be.
In this state, qualified to practice.
Right here.
In this state, any board regulated profession.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you.
Just to expand upon the different statuses that we use. So it's just if you're not active, you should be using the registration. So.
In the weights and measures statute that Deanie had us look at, it had the last provision was nothing shall prohibit the attorney general and the county attorney from pursuing parallel prosecutions or something like that. I'm grossly paraphrasing, but I'm wondering, do we need this? Would that give us a little more authority to refer these out? Does that help? Do you remember seeing that, Deanie, at the bottom? It was like item 6 or something like that.
I don't think it's necessary.
Okay.
It's true no matter what.
Okay. I kind of thought it was implied, but just want to make sure if we're opening the can of worms.
Yes, sir.
It doesn't hurt to put it. It doesn't. it doesn't, I don't know if it accomplishes anything.
If we don't, yeah, if we don't have to, let's not do it.
Kurt, back to number four, you got uses a registration of another what? Do we know?
Give me a moment, sorry.
He's on break.
We're forcing him off the tiny desk to a bigger desk.
To a real desk.
This is crazy.
A real table.
Yeah.
Maintenance just showed up, huh?
Yes.
There we go.
Thank you, everybody. You're awesome.
I have a question about number four, because it seems like sometimes it seems to be true for BTR that you kind of use the word license and then you use registration. I don't know how often you use the word certificate, but it does seem to me that as though you sort of differentiate between license or registration. I'm just wondering if maybe you should, you know, put uses a license or registration of another registrant, another licensee. I know.
It's, you know what? It's very confusing, Deanie. I've had so many discussions with various boards, with attorneys throughout, you know, the associations and other jurisdictions. The way that registration and licensure is thrown around, and then the entities that are adverse to regulation, how they define certifications, registrations, and licensure. It's kind of fascinating big mess.
Well, I was going to suggest, just like Kurt has done here, that deal with it in the definitions by saying registration means a registration, license, or certification that is issued by the board.
And it's already in definitions, is what's here.
Yeah, but the definition has the word that they're defining in the definition.
And we don't.
Do you have the? Do you define license?
No, it does not have any definition of a license. License isn't really anywhere. It's you're registered or you're certified, and this is now. And this definition says if register the use of word registration means registration or certified. So that's why back in my changes, I was cutting out all that language regarding certification or certificate because it used the word registration, which implies
that's
registration
fine.
Or certification.
That's fine. You. That's good.
Okay. I think that makes sense. Even though it does define itself.
But it puts you in circles.
It does put you in an infinite loop.
It does.
You can't get out.
You can't use the word you're defining in the definition. That's the way they taught me back in the day.
Out of curiosity, could you just scroll up for a second, Kurt, just to the beginning of this? Okay. I'm sorry, I have construction going on here. But I do have one thing that has given me heartburn, and it has to do with the case that we just did yesterday. Because the statutes have taken out good moral conduct.
Right.
You have a little hole for somebody who does something dishonest with regard to a client. I don't know how you would cure that, but it seems like you need to sort of plug that hole. You don't really have a way to deal with saying somebody doesn't have the technical skill or expertise, or that they fail to follow that standard of care. Doesn't necessarily cover the situation where somebody actively does something that harms a client that doesn't have to do with technical skill, but more has to do with taking money and not giving them the services they agreed to do.
I had talked with Scott yesterday, and he says that the AAG's office is currently trying to write up an opinion about that. He didn't have an answer for me at that time regarding this. I did create number seven issue regarding that?
Well, at least I'm not barking in the dark.
Because we...
Hey, let's hear what they have to say.
Because we do...
I just... It caused a problem with the case that we just had where, you know, I originally had him charged with bad moral conduct for taking money and not giving the services, and then I had to drop that count because of the recent legislation that took that out of your statute.
Yeah.
But there ought to be something that you could say that says, you know, if you do this bad, something bad to somebody, it's... But, you know, let's just put a pin in that.
Okay.
So the last thing was number five, and that was Judith just wanted to be a bit more broad.
Back to number four, you got uses a registration of another. Of another... What?
Register.
Another register?
That's typically what we would see. As a case.
Uses a register.
You could just say, you could say person, because what if it's not a state registrant, but a registrant in another state? So maybe person.
Another person.
Another person?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'm good all the way to six.
Yep. So.
And then the final thing of this particular issue package is 144, which is the exemptions. So issues this, you guys recall this discussion.
Yeah.
So.
Give us a number, Alejandro. Well,
and I'll just throw in there that I did do another reach out through Bill Nesgood, our current geologist, because he's a contract employee at ADEQ. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to him this morning, sent him the statute, begged him to please light a fire under somebody to get us some verbiage, because I know that this is referenced in municipalities and you know other laws. So hopefully he'll be able to get us some help on that. I know, you know, Alejandro, you chime in on this, but I think personally it shouldn't have a cost, but some other kind of measurement, like
usage measurement.
my point was going to be, why tie it to a dollar value? Why not tie it to a capacity?
Yes.
If you look at exemptions in the architectural and engineering side of things, it's a certain span, it's certain occupant load, it's certain building size.
Mm-hmm.
That building could cost $1 million and only be 2,900 square feet.
I see,
but
that
it doesn't matter. You know, it's the size of the building, and it's the occupant load.
So usage and capacity, yeah.
So I'm saying use so many GPM or gallons or whatever.
Right. I didn't know what to say, but I just knew a dollar amount was bad.
Yeah, that dollar amount, especially in this economy, because $12,000 won't even get the backhoe out there to dig a hole right now, probably.
Well, plus, no matter what number you put in there, it's going to
change.
It's going to
change.
Eventually.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You're always going to have to change.
I mean,
but if you put a capacity on it, if you say it's a 1,500 gallon septic tank.
Or serve so many
units.
Residences or
units.
Or
whatever.
Yeah. To change.
Yeah.
Well, isn't there a break off between, isn't there a definitional break off between a system and what's the other one?
Water treatment plant.
A treatment plant and a treatment facility. That's
what were we looking at, Kurt, when we had this whole discussion? Because we were looking at definitions of water treatment plant, not in our rules, but in Maricopa County or something like that, that you know, needed to jive, and it didn't.
Yeah, it was a plant versus facility. Mm-hmm. That was the designation.
I just remember a million different opinions from lots of different people.
Yep.
A million different opinions, and we never really got anywhere.
No.
And you want to put five?
This is unacceptable, right?
Yeah,
yes.
That's all we know. We know this doesn't work.
That doesn't work.
What if we were to say, not yet?
Well, let's see what your contact at ADEQ comes up with. And Alejandro, if you have some thoughts on capacity, I mean, it's kind of weird because they talk about water or wastewater. And they're really, I don't know that we can say so many GPM or something like that. It doesn't make sense on a water system versus a wastewater system. You know, I think we almost have to segregate out exemptions for water and an exemption for wastewater. What do you think, Alejandro?
I think you're on the right path, Ed. I don't have an answer, but I think, yes, it shouldn't be dollars. It should be capacity. I think we ought to look up what the size of the average septic is for a single family, and then just, you know, I would almost offer draft language to ADEQ and say a non-registrant who designs a residential wastewater treatment plant, that's really what we're talking about, yeah. Not really water treatment.
Well, maybe we get rid of the whole water side of it.
I'm not sure you want to get rid of the water side of it because, for example, rest areas serve 4,000 or 5,000 people a day. And that's a water
If you get rid of it, it means they need to be registered. You don't need to be registered if you're doing a residential wastewater treatment, a.k.a.
In the home inspection industry, we work with 4 units or less. So maybe that would be a good place to call.
In our cutoff for a registrant is 3 units or less. For multi-family.
Anybody got 2 or less?
So I'm just saying, maybe because it's tied more to the design side of it, we say, okay, if it's 3 units or less, residential, it's exempt for wastewater treatment.
Well, 3 units or less would be a good place to start then.
But I'm not sure you need units because it's based on number of people, right? I mean,
generally.
Like a septic, I'm looking up online, and this is something we should consult, but it says a house with 5 bedrooms would need a septic tank between 1,500 and 3,000 gallons.
Right.
So just if we said 3,000 gallons,
residential,
3,000 gallons, even if it's multifamily, it won't be a lot of houses or apartments or anything.
So residential, 3,000 gallons or less.
I like that for a start.
Yeah.
It's a great starting point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's where you have the highlighted stuff. Kurt, just say, if the total tank capacity is less than 3,000, or if the total system capacity is less than 3,000 gallons.
Yeah.
What does it say for gallons per minute for water flow? Because we still have water in here.
That's why I was advocating for getting rid of water.
I think getting rid of water, I think because if it's a rest area, it's a public works project. It's got to have a registrant anyway.
But Ed, is the water issue, no, I'm not the professional here, I feel stupid saying this, does it have to do with like putting in a water retention system, a well or anything like that?
Well, I think wells come under a whole other set of regulations. And I think it's to me I guess
water systems are everything from treatment of the water for reverse osmosis or electrodialysis types of things. And again, cases they come under public works, but we also have got a lot of properties in Arizona that there are 3 or 5 residences tied into one system.
That's a fact.
That is a nightmare to the people when they don't function.
Maybe we ought to pull water into a separate paragraph.
Well, I guess if we're going to deal with water, I think it needs to be dealt with separately, and then I think they both just need to have a residential bent to them. If it's commercial, Even if it's commercial and only 3,000 gallons, it's not
And what if we said wastewater treatment system instead of facility or plant? Would that work better to be more general?
I like that because there's multiple. Yes. I think that's good. What do you
think? System is part of the plant.
Because plant was really part of a problem I had.
Do we need to get into the extensions, additions, modifications? I mean, if we just say it's a 3,000-gallon residential, if they have to come in and modify the leaching field or swap out the tank or something, as long as they don't go over that 3,000-gallon, I don't think we need to get into the minutia of additions, modifications, all of that, necessarily.
I have no idea. I'm just going to go with...
And then how do we deal with water? I mean, you know... An individual house might, I mean, are we, if they're talking water treatment, we're talking RO systems, we're talking water softeners, they're all under a certain capacity, but I don't have the mechanical engineering knowledge to know how big of a system we would cut it off at.
So, but isn't the practice of engineering already exempt for residential single families?
Yeah, so... But I think the exemption applies to up to two units or three units. I'm drawing a blank.
I am too. I've always thought it was one unit, but I'm not sure.
No, because you can do a non-registrants. I know can do duplexes. I just don't know if they can do a triplex. I can't remember. Oh, here we go.
This is Jeannie. Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
If you scroll up a little bit to three.
Yep, I'm right there.
The one where we were, we're not there yet. The exemptions for water and wastewater. Oh, there it is. Okay, it's six. I'm sorry. If you just say design, then does that mean it's just like a new design?
Yep.
And then if they modify it in some way, they're not exempt or they are exempt. I'm kind of questioning the taking out extensions, additions, modifications, and extensions, et cetera.
What if it was a non-registrant who designs or modifies a residential water or wastewater
treatment
works.
System?
But yeah,
that
like
works.
That's good.
Designs or modifies.
Modifies a residential
wastewater.
We got to deal with water separately, I think.
And maybe not. Because if you take out water, yeah. Kurt, and go back to number three, to the extension number three.
That covers detached single family dwelling or.
I guess that's more structural, right? But
B is more structural.
But I think if you were to add a water softener to a single-family house, you could say, look, I'm just, altering a detached single-family dwelling.
Right.
And to be taken even further, I think adding a water softener to a house is not designing a treatment system. It's installing it. Somebody already designed it.
Yeah.
It's installing a treatment system. That's why I'm not sure we need water in that exemption.
But do we need something else that addresses water?
I'm not sure that we do. Now that I'm kind of agreeing with Alejandro on this, there's the size of the water line coming into the house, a non-registrant could design that. There's tables in the International Plumbing Code that would tell you
everything you need to know.
Everything you need to know.
The Dr. Angel, what was that 3,000 gallons? What was the unit on that? We need to put that unit in there.
It was the total tank capacity for the sewer.
Tank capacity.
tank capacity, yeah.
Okay, so a system tank capacity is 3,000 gallons or less.
Okay.
Not a flow.
Yeah, I put that, you know, highlighted in case ADEQ has better ideas. I mean, I'm not a septic engineer. But I think it's a good starting point. They can help us from there.
Yeah, I think send this to them and we can, and they can give us feedback.
Okay.
So we're limiting that to single family, one unit, actually. That 3,000 gallons was it one unit, five bedroom, wasn't it? Something like that?
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Yeah, one unit. So we've, that's the worst of the three and the four.
Yeah.
Okay.
Someone has a McMansion that's 10,000 square feet, they probably can't just have a 3,000 gallon tank.
Two or three.
Well, I guess you could see that happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have.
If you guys are okay with this language, again, I took it from the definitions and put it here. I had to put an engineer, comma, geologist, or a land surveyor. I just
want
to make sure that it reads like it's supposed to.
Yep.
Asking me, are you asking me a question, Kurt? I can't hear you very well.
I'm asking everyone.
Okay.
Get that satellite closer to me.
You talking about number two?
Yeah.
That's the miner's exclusion?
No, that's
good. Yep.
I get the satellite closer to me.
I have no problem.
Number three was just to raise eyebrows.
I'm a little concerned about that.
As you should be. It's more out there to kind of start. Is there any way, shape, or form to define when you use a seal or not?
Well, so it says the requirements of the chapter shall not apply to engineering work done by a person that the board or any, and what I have real heartburn over is or any other jurisdiction of this state does not require the use of a seal. It opens the door for a municipality to interpret our statutes and say, oh, you're just doing interior design work, so you don't. This doesn't need to be sealed by an architect or an engineer.
And again, it's not. It
muddies the waters on exemptions because
it makes it impossible.
Cases where we had an interior designer come in and said, "Well, I only worked on 800 square feet," even though they had hired the mechanical engineer to do mechanical for this whole thing, an electrical engineer to do this and all of this, which covered the whole building. We had a really good solid case and said, nope, you needed an architect because the whole thing was like 7,000 feet.
Yeah, that's fine. I just was curious if you guys knew of anything out there where the actual use of seals is defined somehow, some way. I don't think one really exists because we use public safety as the what it is. So I just wanted to throw that out there just for discussion.
I would get rid of it.
It doesn't really make sense anyway.
It's not really tied in, but I think it'll cause problems because in that case the city of Mesa said, oh yeah, you're exempt, no problem. Well, they were interpreting the board's statutes and rules.
Or making their own, because they can write their own code that says you don't need to be registered to do this and that, and every jurisdiction could do it differently.
Yeah.
Okay.
Whoa, slide back there for a minute. Instead of talking about home inspectors there, except that nothing in this chapter prevents...
Well, see, this part I was saying is... We already have language in our statutes that say you can't advertise or, you know, put yourself out there that you're registered. So it just seemed redundant in saying something that's already been said.
All right.
And then scratching out the geologist and putting it into definitions. I guess that was it for the exemptions. Or this was just part of the whole definition Smith Valley. I just wanted to make sure that this was moved here. And we covered this issue that AD and QA brought up before.
Yep.
So that's number
can I ask a question about, can I ask a question about six? You're saying modifies the residential, or get taken out water.
Yes.
Okay. All right, never mind.
Feel good about this package, and I'll put the model law definitions in there, and then I could probably share it with everybody, but thank you for going through all the other bits.
Sure.
Your opinions on that.
Thank you.
I guess we can look at maybe the next one, comedy. Or did you have a specific thing you guys wanted to look at some more?
We didn't do anything with water when we were working with wastewater.
Let's we'll see if we get some response from ADEQ to help us on that.
On the water?
Yeah, because I think we don't have an answer on that one.
Okay.
Yeah.
You might want to put a number 7 in there with the word water just to remind you.
That's true. It's older.
That we didn't
most
do anything
of that's
with
covered
water.
In under with wells, but most of the water supply here is
it's either
from
city
wells.
Or well. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah, there's lots of regulations about water wells. And covered by AWR
and ADEQ.
Mm-hmm. All right.
That was for water.
There you go. Question marks.
Okay. So let me get to the 2019 endorsement language.
You know, Kurt, just thinking about your wonderful introduction there that talks about the issue. I think part of the issue should be also recognizing that the majority of the professionals are licensed in multiple states. I mean, that's really the norm. And also that, I don't know, somehow how do we say, yes, we have universal, but that requires residency in the state. And again, they're all licensed in multiple states, so.
Is there gonna be projects that cross state lines and things like that. So.
I mean, I would think so. Would Ed and Alejandro, wouldn't that be the norm, and Leroy, to have projects crossing state lines as well, which is part of the reason you guys are licensed in multiple states?
No, I
buildings.
Yeah. I mean, usually it's individual buildings, and that's why I'd have to get licensed in state.
Yeah, it's not so much about projects crossing state lines. It's some people work in multiple states, but I would probably guess that less than half are registrants are registered in other states.
Ooh, I bet it's more than that.
Quite a number. Okay. I'm trying to think of the numbers, but I feel like a third of registrants in the state do not reside in this state. We have to give those numbers to NCARBON NCs annually.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like I can almost remember Melissa saying specifically that with geologists that was an issue with crossing state lines and needing to be multi-state.
Well, for instance, I'm working in Ivanpah Valley, which crosses between Nevada and California. So I'm working in both at the same time.
I don't even
know
where that is.
I'm just, that's a basin that I work in. That covers two states. And there's basins like that here, around the edges of the state. So
okay.
It's never been an issue.
Right. Well, just talking about the ease of getting licensed in Arizona. So, and I mean, if you're a California resident, you're working in the basin, you know, to do universal, you'd have to move here and establish residency, you know, versus comedy would make it real easy. So
well,
I think that's
a California,
valid point, right?
I got registered in California, and because I had to take the ASBOG exam to pass there, I also got registered in Oregon and Washington and Alaska, you know, and I was registered here. So And that was all through just filling out some forms and sending them in. It was very, very easy. We should do that.
I agree.
But I think this is a two-sided thing. Is one is make it easier for people to get licensed here, which is what everybody wants. But it's also for those people that say that there aren't enough engineers or surveyors or architects. If we can say, look, we're making it, we're by allowing anybody to get registered easily here, there'll be a bigger pool of people to do work, and you know, trying to provide options for people.
Right. As a surveyor, you know, the only thing, as long as we keep the state exam in place, that has to be. The laws, you know, the engineering, practicing standards are pretty universal, but surveying boundary law is what we're licensed for, so that's different in every state.
Agree.
That is in the endorsement language. I highlighted it up here. That would still be a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
So let's go up to paragraph 3, A and B. I'm wondering why they have to satisfy both A and B. Because I think if you hold a certification in good standing from a national council recognized by the board, it implies you meet some of the aspects of A. I'm concerned if we're going to accept an NCWS folder or an NCARB blue folder
or a CLARB
folder.
So with these people,
that ought to be it.
Council folders, right? Council records.
Right, but I think what we need to do is we have to make it an or. Instead of both.
Yep.
Okay.
I think you either have a certificate in good standing through one of the national councils, or you meet these criteria. Because quite honestly, I don't understand demonstrates active practice for 5 years in a particular state. We have folks that maybe started out on their pathway to, you know, and it's a little different now, but you know, they might have started out on their examination pathway in New Mexico, so they just get their New Mexico license because it was easier for them. But they're working here now, and they ought to be able to get their Arizona license. If they had applied in Arizona, we would have given it to them.
Makes sense. So A or B,
right.
And B is the council record.
Yeah. So I mean, if they got licensed in New Mexico and turned right around, you know, they have their NCARB certificate now for their initial licensure. They turn right around. They apply to Arizona to get licensed. So we're talking a month or 2 months or whatever. And they apply to Arizona for their license, and they have NCARB transmit their record. You should grant them a license. They've shown that they're qualified.
I agree. Do we need to, and you guys can shoot me down on this, but do we need to have something in here about Canada, or, you know, this is specific to United States territories?
I think we need to wordsmith that, because there are NCARB. Let's see, and maybe Maurice or who else is on from NCARB? Josh? You know, through our MRA with Canada, they could come.
And they could soon get, to be and, the United and the, Kingdom.
And the United Kingdom, all these MRAs we have, they would get it. They would have an NCARB certificate. They could apply and get it transferred.
So
I would be under 3B, right? Is what you're saying, Ed?
Yeah.
I worry about specifically
United States territory. What if we just said in each jurisdiction?
You've got a problem if you've got somebody who's got some certification from some weird jurisdiction.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the problem we've had, is every time you include foreign countries, there are some countries that have registration requirements more stringent than us, and there's countries that have significantly less stringent.
Well, but if they hold a council record...
If they hold a council record, they're in.
Right, I agree. So that's why, but reading B, it says, verifies having registration or certification in good standing for all registration, or holds a certificate of qualification in good standing issued by a United States National Council. That could almost be C. In fact, that...
Yeah, there you go. Make it C.
Or is the first part of B even needed? What does that say by itself?
Well, I'm thinking B...
That's already under A. Under A, you have valid in good standing and have done it for 5 years, and it's similar. So you could pick path. One path is through the NCARB or NCES or whatever it is. The other path is registration in good standing from another state or territory that has similar requirements, and you practice for 5 years. I'm not sure that the B we have right now is necessary.
I would agree.
So you said, Alejandro, are you saying a United States, like under 3A, I, there, United States territory or
nope.
Something?
I think you leave that one alone. I'm saying we don't need B as currently written.
I think we get rid of B.
So now A allows anyone who's registered in the U.S. and a state or territory. And then under B is anyone, I mean, they can also be similar to A where they're from another state, or they can be from out of country as long as NCES or NCARB have said, yeah, you're comparable to our folks here.
Okay, I'm not trying to be difficult, I promise, but even Canada, even you don't want to...
In the past, I've had reviewed some Clark stuff from registrants in Canada, also Mexico and Australia.
And quite honestly, for NCARB, if it's Canada, we have an MRA. They have a certificate.
Yeah.
Okay.
We have.
And I think
in Mexico, it's the same thing through Tri-National.
One of my issues with our rules is that we say lab accredited, but we don't have LAAC for Canada, and I wish it said something about that. But
Judith, I'm not sure I would allow Canada to come in automatically unless NCES said they were okay. There are some provinces in Canada that have different levels of registration that we're not super familiar with. There's other where they only have to take ethics exams to get their license, and yet there's others that are more complicated. So,
okay, I'm okay with that.
We have a section that deals with foreign.
In rule, we have.
In rules. But we don't have anything in statute. Because, theoretically, we could rewrite a rule, we could write a statute that says if you're coming from Japan, you have to take the ARE. We don't have an MRA with them that would give them an NCARB certificate that would allow them to have, you know, apply through that route, which would be B.
Interesting point then, because if we do eliminate the exam waiver, if we are able to have comedy instead, would that be looked at as prohibitive? Then you're saying we can't waive the exam if they haven't had the exam. I don't know. Maybe that's what you want.
I think
that's what I want. They can just take the exam and pass it. Take the exam, you pass it, you provide certificates of experience, and you get registered like everybody else.
We got rid of the whole broadly experienced foreign architect program and said complete AXP and take the exam.
Yeah.
Unless you're under an MRA.
The current language for the exemption of exam... So they'll waive the examination if you hold a valid certificate of registration, good standing in another state or foreign country with the requirements for registration substantially identical to those of the state.
So,
and then you can have the professional exam waived, or the old certificate from, you know, NCES or NCARB, which I don't see how you guys would get a record with. without passing the exams, but
or through an MRA. Mm-hmm. So the concern is who will evaluate the substantial equivalency?
Substantially
identical to those of this state.
Well, Julie, who does
you.
That?
So currently.
The reason I say who would do that is if you look at the latest effort that the committee did to come up with the UK MRA, oh my goodness. I mean, it's this giant matrix of here's our requirements, here's their requirements. How do these things align? How does the education line up? How does the experience line up? How does the examination line up? It's not easy.
And it's I think it puts the reviewers in a very tough spot. I personally felt very conflicted at times when people from other countries came up, because they all have different requirements, and sometimes you can't tell. The biggest loophole in my mind was three there, because it doesn't even require substantial equivalency. It just says, if you've been working in a foreign country as a registrant for 10 years and you have a certificate from that country, you're good to go.
Yeah,
that's the current thing.
And you can't say no. All they have to show is that they have a license, and that's it.
And I think that's
10 years.
I think that could be problematic.
Oh, yeah.
And because this is part of the reason we're looking at, unless we have the MRA, if we're looking at a foreign architect, what's their knowledge of U.S. codes and regulations, you know, all of that?
And their education
requirements
are different.
Yeah.
Their universities teach different things.
A lot of them, you know, they go for 5 years, they take their exit exam, and they are a licensed architect. Mm-hmm.
I was going to point out, in our notes here, I was going to basically request that you wanted to scratch out pretty much all of the waiver, except for the fundamentals part down here, for the reasons that you've expressed, and as far from the language that we're proposing, it seems redundant to have these waivers when you can just get licensed.
Well, I think we have to come up with a mechanism to recognize so that we're not accused of, you know, restraining.
Or didn't we just do that people. Above this?
Well, I don't know that we have when it comes to the foreign architects.
Well,
that aren't under an MRA.
So what happened with the language that we were looking at?
Change the language to say you got to take the exam.
I mean, we
the experience
recognize
and exam requirement.
Any MRAs here. I mean, I know NCAR does, right? And so if they have a council record, again, that's all great. But none of our language.
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not saying don't refer to MRAs. If NCARB has an MRA, then we accept the NCARB
certificate.
Right.
Endorsed certificate, then we're good.
Anybody that has a council record, that's...
They're in.
Yeah.
Well, I do have a question about that, because I know NCARB has the NCARB certificate.
Correct.
But as far as like NCES or CLARB, I don't know if there's something identical to that where they have to apply for the and I don't know if I just, because I know you can have an NCAR or a NCES record, but they're not licensed anywhere else. So we get their record, it shows their education, their exams, and their experience, but they're not.
So knowing that,
licensed anywhere else.
Can we just
NCES refers to that, Julia, as a model law engineer.
Okay.
Is what the standard is. So if the certification is that if NCES certifies that they're a model law engineer, it means they have the education, experience, and exams that most states would accept.
Okay, but do they have to be licensed anywhere else or not for it to be a model law?
I can't think of any case where they wouldn't. Okay. I mean, I get, unless I'm not understanding, not every engineer is a model law engineer. But every model law engineer is a registered engineer.
Okay.
It's basically a higher standard. It's just they have to have taken the exam, they have to have had the experience, and they ask them that they graduate from an ABET school to have one of those certificates. I think the way this is written is great, as Colonel
currently shown on the screen.
So can we eliminate all the waivers?
Yeah, except the FE, maybe? I mean, all the other waivers.
I would like to see us eliminate the waivers, but we still have to write some kind of language that addresses foreign architect applicants. Or foreign, I'm sorry, foreign registered applicants.
Well, I thought you did with the last chapter in the definitions. Go up a little bit further. Didn't we just add that for the foreigners? Go up a little further. No, out of the red, into the blue.
Oh.
What's that last one? Not there.
Just back to where we were before.
Yeah, where we were before. There you go.
No, because we say
there, number 3B.
3B, no, but that's if NCWS, NCARB, CLARB, any of those have a mutual recognition agreement with a foreign country, then we have the mechanism, but we don't have MRAs with all foreign countries. So, again, using Japan as an example, don't have an MRA with them. Somebody from Japan comes over, wants to practice. What are our requirements going to be?
Ed, but
an application.
But this statute is only for licensure by endorsement. So if someone comes from Japan or any other country and they want to be licensed here, they just follow the standard process. They take the exam, they demonstrate experience, education, and get licensed.
As long as
that's
clear, then
the heading is licensure by endorsement.
Yeah, okay.
And this is a separate statute, the exemptions. It's not part of that. And that's the question is, do you want foreign applicants to have their exams waived? And I think the consensus usually is no, we don't.
We do not. So I think that helps clear it. Sorry.
So can we get rid of these waivers?
Cool. We've been here a long time.
I know.
So we can blow away the waivers, right?
I think so. With the exception... So maybe, we take away A.
We have a couple of agreements currently for those architects from Sonora, Mexico.
We do have that, yes. We do have to be careful.
And
but that's kind of a, for lack of a better term, and I'm sure it's the wrong one, a reciprocity agreement. And I don't know how many people have really used it.
It's not.
I have not been able to find it.
Do you? I don't know what you're talking about.
It'd be interesting to see.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we have an agreement with the state of Sonora for reciprocity or comedy, whatever we call it.
Yeah. Reciprocity.
Yeah.
Would you say that this removal of this language doesn't affect that?
No.
I don't think so.
B is a little different. This one's about let's say, example, civil engineer, you're doing structural stuff, and you can prove that you have structural experience for 4 years, you can get your structural seal. And it just seemed like, I think...
So, Kurt, one definitely needs to go there, because that's the loophole by which people get their structural license without taking the exam, by just showing that they've been working in the structural field. I could see either getting rid of B completely, or just saying... shall submit evidence to the board of successful completion of the professional examination in the branch of engineering. That way, they don't have to go through the whole process again, but just to show that they passed that exam.
So we need to get rid of, so we shall submit evidence to the board
of
successful
completion. Just take out the either and just say
either.
Of successful completion of the exam. If they take the exam and pass it, we'll give them their other license. I think by having one license, they've already demonstrated good moral character. They've already demonstrated they have engineering experience. They just have to show that they can pass the exam. Kurt, so you would just make that A, period, a registered professional.
Yeah, he has.
Right? Because A is, you got it.
Yep.
And then you got your, now you're down to your surveyor's exception there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That's good.
But for successful completion, successful would not be capitalized if you're including it into the sentence above.
Okay.
Right.
Deceiving and remain. Because it's not really a different A now, so it's kind of redundant.
Well,
I think it needs to stay. It just needs to be wordsmith to refer to the.
Well, subsection A is gone now. Mm-hmm. And I think on the licensure by endorsement, we already referred or referenced passing the state-specific exam, didn't we?
Correct.
Yes. That's still in the top piece, yeah.
Yeah. So I would think we can get rid of it.
Scroll back down to it, Kurt. Yeah, as long as the state exam is covered in the top piece, I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Would you say, Julie, can you hear you?
So would we want to leave that for those not applying to endorsement?
We just have to talk. loud
to the reporter. It's because if they go through the normal, because this is all about exemptions, and so the actual way of getting licensure as a land surveyor wouldn't change. This is just if you happen to get your fundamentals or your professional exempt, you would still be required to take that state specific. But now that no exam exemptions, there's no need to say if it's already part of the actual registration process.
Just to clarify, you're saying that the surveyors that come into the state from another state are going to have to take this exam regardless?
Regardless.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's state-specific, correct.
Yeah. And they should. Specific exam, yes. That's pretty much that's the way it is in every state.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just basically because of laws.
Every state's got a state-specific exam then?
Yep.
Okay. Thank you.
B was more, we wanted to make some changes because as far as I understand it, like ABIT and other accrediting entities accredit degree programs, not specifically schools. Is that correct?
Is that, you repeat the question, please? We were focused on something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We got distracted. No, we got distracted. What was your question?
On B. We had used, we had changed school and curriculum to professional education degree program because we feel ABIT and other entities such as ABIT that are credit, they accredit degree programs, not specific schools. Is that a correct, am I correct saying that?
ABIT accredits specific schools based on an ABIT standard.
Yeah.
Specific degree program. Not every degree from a school is accredited.
Right, it's the specific program that would be accredited. So NAB would accredit Arizona State University. They accredit the University of Arizona for their bachelor and master's mm-hmm. programs. So it's specific programs within a given university.
Okay, so actually that's a college we did that.
I'm not sure you need to change any of this, Kurt, other than remove the in-training and replace it with the other stuff, but the second part has never been an issue, is, if it's a graduate of a school and curriculum approved by the board and has been actively engaged, blah, blah, blah.
I guess that's what
has never been an issue.
I would question the approved by the board. I think I'm fine with school and curriculum, but the board, at least in my experience, doesn't approve the school or curriculum.
Well, by policy, I guess, and maybe there's a better way to do it, we've said that ABIT is something we approve or recognize for engineering.
Julie, you know the top of your head the rule that specifies... Right. That gets more specific about this is education credit. The board shall grant credit according to the following: architectural applicants with the National Architectural Accrediting Board accredited degree NAB 60 months. So it does it based on the accreditation that way.
Yeah. I guess the question is, are we only accepting accredited degree programs to qualify for this?
Yes. That would be, I think if you're...
Because this is to get an extra benefit to get a waiver.
It should be education from an accredited institution.
I think that would eliminate geologists then, because there's no accredited...
Well, let me ask a question here, because the American Institute of Professional Geologists has a certified professional geologist certification, and they're creating a new one called CPGA, which will require the applicant to take the ASBAR exam. And in the process of applying for this certification, you have to show that you've had the education, all the things that the state requires. So is it possible that that could be recognized as well? It's an AIPG certification. Because if that's true, I was the national president, so I can go back to the board and say, this is possible. Maybe it's not right now, not in this language, but...
It could be added to rule, because rule is where it specifies how mm-hmm. much credit is awarded based on the curriculum
right.
or accreditation.
Okay.
So it sounds like you want to keep school and curriculum. And we're on the fence between approved and recognized as...
I would take the as such, just say recognized by the board. And yeah.
Yeah. I like that.
Okay. Let's go.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's 12 years.
Yeah, what's so magic about 12 years?
They retire after 12 years.
You know, I and this is something that I kind of look at several years ago when we changed from the IDP program to AXP, we reduced the seat time pretty significantly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, part of what helped me get my head around that was being an old guy. When we would draw a project, we'd do a schematic design set of drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of put those in the drawer, and then you redrew everything, and you did a design development set, and then you put those in the drawer, and then you redrew it again and did your construction documents.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time redrawing the same stuff over and over. Did I learn much new?
You learned
probably
pencil
not.
Weight.
I learned how to be a really, really good draftsperson.
Right.
Nowadays, it's all computer. It's all computer, and we don't redraw anything. I mean, I start a model, I hand it off to a staff member, and they fix it because
mm-hmm.
they don't like Ed models,
mm-hmm.
and they make it work, and we produce a set of documents from that.
Mm-hmm.
The knowledge that's imparted through that is the same, but in a much more abbreviated time period. And
every
so
time you slid a plate into the drawer, you learn something. You know, you saw your mistakes when you pulled the next plate up. This computer stuff is not the same experience, in my opinion.
But it's, I mean, in my opinion, it's you're learning a lot in a shorter period of time. I just don't, and seat time to me is not that important. It's are you learning and are you becoming competent at what you do? Because you could sit there for 10 years and not be very good.
Designer, but a great draftsperson.
Yeah. So, you know, I think 12 years just seems like a long time.
It does seem like a long time.
What do you think, Alejandro?
You're talking about the fundamentals here.
I just don't. It's hard to find an objective number, right?
Yeah.
In my mind, because, like you said, all experience is different experience.
Yep.
It's a long time, but it's also we're requiring 12 years to get the benefit of skipping an exam. You can always take the exam and pass it. So, I don't know, what does it say if you have 8 years and you've been trying to pass it, you haven't, and we said 8 would allow you to bypass it. I don't know. So I wasn't thinking of changing the 12 just because we don't have any objective data to say that anything less or more is good. So I was leaving it alone in my mind.
I would agree with that.
Okay.
Julie, how often do people apply for the fundamentals exemption?
It does happen.
Yeah. We're one of the few states that allow people to get a license without passing the FE exam, even after 12 years. Most states require them to pass it. And the problem is, again, if you haven't passed it in 10 years, you're never going to pass it because it's stuff that you learned in school and you don't use as much. This is an alternative path, which I think is a good thing.
Okay. I'm fine. I'm not going to die on that hill. I think 12, if you guys are comfortable with 12, I'm good.
Well, you've convinced me that we shouldn't make an exemption at all, but that's up to you guys.
Yeah, but we want to help people get licensed, right? They still have to pass the PE exam.
I think if we eliminate this, we're going counter to the climate of the state for regulation.
And that's been on the books since I started in the 80s.
I also, in surveying the in-training exam, we have a lot, at one time, there's a lot of guys I've worked with that got their LSIT, and that's as far as they went. They never had any issue. They didn't want to go beyond that. So being exempt from it's kind of like, you know, we just take that. I mean, it's not, and surveying, I don't think that's as big an issue. I could see in engineering where it might be. Of course, we also don't have a solid education program evenly across the country either. So it's that part's really difficult in surveying.
And I moved to this state from another state, and I took advantage of that 12-year thing, so I didn't have to take it here. And that helped me get to the professional exam quicker. So it was worth it.
And I think that's the intent.
Okay. I'll move right along.
We're going to go back up because we kind of stopped at the A, B here, and then there's more beyond that. So this will have to be
I didn't have any issue with anything here, Kurt, except, not an issue, but I highlighted the good moral character under the last item B.
Yes, because that's been removed from everything else, so I imagine it. I had highlighted it, assuming that we would probably have to scratch it.
We don't require good moral character anymore?
Nope.
Not according to the state.
So I can get naked and run down the street now?
No.
That's a good question.
you still might get arrested, but it won't affect your certification.
It won't affect my business? Let's go.
What I will say is that then I saw you had text for defining good moral character and rule, basically. Is yes. that what you had, Kurt? That looked good to me.
I think that's
my you were first. Looking to do.
Let me just check.
Remember,
because that was my.
Oh, I knew you had something here.
It's my issue number 7. This is the law they just went through, Peter. Sorry, let me share with everybody else so they can see.
The whole package was like 150 pages long because they removed the main character from
everything.
Every board. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're good. We're not alone this time.
Yeah. Right, so everybody, you know, got good moral character and they do scratched out.
Hmm.
Not just us.
Wow. And they, anybody give a reason for that?
This is our current
penalizing people who pass mistakes.
Prevents them from getting licensed and working, is what my guess is. But yeah, these are our current definitions, rules of good moral character, which I've asked Scott D. you know, please tell me if this even applies anymore since they scratched out a statute. Do we even have this? I don't know. I don't know if it invalidates it or something.
I don't know. I mean, we can talk about rules later. I don't want to get into rules right now, but.
Oh yeah, that's this part was here was having 123 and kind of specifying narrow, you know, saying it here how we can deny someone's application, and the application is a renewal or a normal app, and then it specifies some of those good moral character things in statute.
I think we might have to do something with unprofessional conduct, elaborate on that more or something, since I just don't know how Kirk would look at that when it's been removed out of everything and very intentionally that we're trying to, you know,
take it back in
and retain it and rule and even clarify it or talk about it at all. I think we have to look at it in a different way.
So this might just have to wait until the AG's office, or the AG's office gives us their kind of their opinion on it move forward, but I want to at least have the idea that it could be put to statute. So I'll go back to our endorsement. So for this time, is D, does that just need to be removed in its entirety? I guess it's supposed to be more inclusive by saying that we don't care about that, but it might not be a factor anymore because they remove good moral character and repute from the statutes.
So one caveat I would have is somewhere, and this has nothing to do with the statutes or the rules, but you know, we asked that question on applications and renewal applications, and if that gets pulled off, I think we need something somewhere that says you're no longer required to report this, but be aware that you may still have to report it to other jurisdictions. Because people miss this all the time, and it's one of the things that people would get dinged for, even here, because they would fail to disclose a conviction on their renewal or their initial application, and it would cause them a problem. We would do a background check and go, oh, you didn't report that you had a DUI or that you had this or you had that. And, you know, some of them ended up being reasonably related to the practice, to their practice. And it could be they were found to be a sex offender and we had to put limits on their practice regarding schools or something like that. So I just want to make sure that we kind of help protect them from themselves, that they don't just think, oh, I don't have to report it in Arizona. And then, you know, they renew in New Mexico and they have to report it.
Get to think about, because I know we're probably going to have to revise our forms. We just got to wait for that opinion to come out.
Well, just a question here, Kurt. Why would you not state this in the reverse, which is the board or executive director may deny registration or certification by endorsement to an applicant who has been convicted of a felony or crime that is reasonably related to the profession for which the registration or certificate is sought?
Yeah, well, you need to take out executive director now because the board is the only one that's going to deny.
Because we're not referencing moral character or repute. We're just saying if you've got a felony conviction, that we need to have some protections for that exact example that I just gave.
There needs to be some smithing as well for reasonably related. It needs to be would reasonably negatively affect or something like that.
Pretty well to me right now.
I think so. So,
you lost the whole part about rehabilitation on there, though.
Yeah, I just.
Well, wouldn't that, I mean, you'd be able to explain that in defense. So, like, I had a felony, but I've done this, this, and this to mediate that, or my records have been expunged, or I've done this, or whatever. I think that would just be something you would be able to, you know, offer up as an explanation to the board before they denied you.
Yeah, because every applicant that's denied would have has an opportunity to come and,
right,
and talk to the
board. Right.
Yeah.
True. Right.
Just because we've been having this issue where we have people who have something on their record from 20 years ago and still have to go before the board because there's nothing that says.
So let's change it to preceding, not proceeding.
Oh, thank you.
And make sure that we, as we wordsmith this, mm-hmm. a lot of those references tie into the renewal cycle. So it's a 3-year period. In other words, if you look at the application, it says, since your last renewal, have you been convicted of X? And so we have 5 years here, which means they would have
so
to report it twice.
Application,
is this
should
initial?
Should we say that? 5 years of initial application or?
Oh, that's right, because this is under, this is
the endorsement.
Endorsement, so.
Okay, right.
Okay, so we're
so
fine then.
Yeah.
Sorry, I just.
It's all right, you got to talk these things
trying to
through.
Think it all through.
So we liked, last is the home inspector bit, which is C.
Well, that's fine.
Preceding only has one E in it?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
What?
Yeah, just looked wrong.
I looked at it and I thought that's not
what word?
Preceding.
Oh, preceding only has that one E.
Yep.
Mm-mm.
So do we have the reference? Does 32122.0, is that the fingerprint clearance?
That is basically the whole, application for registration as a home inspector. So you have to be 18, good moral character is obviously gone,
yeah.
Pass the exam, course of study, pay a fee.
And the I see the fingerprint clearance.
So you just discharge these 5 years, provide evidence of principal and obtain financial assurance. No, that's B. But yeah. So they be registered here, they have to meet all the requirements under the normal certification. So they have to get their FA, a fingerprint clearance card.
Okay.
And then also give us a home inspection from the original state they're coming from.
Why would we do that?
And then proof of completing pool and spa course.
I'm not sure. I'm confused about that too because we don't even require that. They don't even have to. They don't have to. Why do we have that,
well,
Peter? Sorry, go ahead.
No,
Julie.
I was going to say.
Good question. I didn't write.
The requirements,
this is endorsement, right? Are we talking about endorsement? So
if they have to satisfy everything
under
regular, then what's the point of the endorsement?
I understand. And that's, again, this is exactly how it was written in 2019.
Wow.
Yeah, so I would pull that out. I mean,
so if this is supposed to be like by comedy or whatever, first of all, I don't know why we need their home inspection report. Because if they're licensed in another state.
Well, especially that says, especially when it says meets the standards of professional practice in this state, which
right?
means if they have a different format in New Mexico and New Mexico requires completely different information, what do they have to do? They have to transcribe it into Arizona's format so you can take a look at it, Peter? It just doesn't make sense.
The only advantage to taking a home inspection report from them from someplace else is to see if it meets our standard and to give them a heads up on it. That'd be about the only thing.
So you can give them a little critique, but I would just, if we leave it in there, I would just say in the applicant's original state of certification, period, get rid of the rest of the sentence. Sorry.
I don't want to look at their report from another state, and I don't feel like it's the board's job to to give them a heads up on something. If they're coming here and they want to be licensed here, they have to be responsible. The onus is on them to be responsible for knowing Arizona requirements.
Well, and it's interesting because we don't ask for, let's say an architect doesn't have an in-carved certificate, but they're coming in through this.
I know,
this
but home inspectors are children.
Well, you just take this out and make mentally alarm agents and say,
we don't
can't,
ask them for an example of work.
They don't have comedy.
Yeah, I got no problem with blowing all this away. But the complaints that I've had is, well, you certified my home inspection. You know, you didn't tell me that when I got licensed. You know, these are their defenses when they're sitting in an EAC committee. Well, that passed the muster when I got licensed. My report was exactly like this. So that would be my only thing, is to look at it and say, oh, my God, they don't meet any of our things. But we can do that in an enforcement advisory committee as well as, I mean, even better than in registration.
We have a HIRC next week, so maybe we should hash this over then.
Sure, that'd be a great idea.
I can add it on there. We haven't posted the agenda. It's going to be posted today.
Let's do that.
But if you're talking about comedy, we shouldn't be requiring anything. It should be
right.
Just,
right.
You know, if we're going to accept their past history in another state, just accept it full bore. You know, if the board feels that it is equivalent. And then let it go at that, and then they'll learn through experience what exactly is required, because they will get
it.
Fingerprint card and FA, which would be the only requirements.
FA, 4D.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do that in our meeting next week and really get down on that.
Wednesday, I think, 7th.
Yep.
Yes.
I believe you.
Well, you don't remember.
I don't want to derail anything, but I so apparently somebody who runs a water treatment facility and a couple of other opinions are that 3,000 gallon capacity that's a good number for residential.
Okay.
And then I'll circle back on the water issue.
Okay.
But
great.
I think that's a great idea to separate it in it.
Mm-hmm. And we may not even need water. And most of the systems are already designed. Culligan designs their water softener.
Section B is that thing.
It's
that
funny.
Comes
out.
Yeah, but there's
highlighted.
Now, water.
Water systems. Mm-hmm.
Some of these water systems for 4 and 5 families up in the middle of nowhere, are complicated.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're looking at pumps, storage tanks, retention, all sorts of, piping, anti-siphon. It's just
crazy.
I think we do need to address
it.
Sorry, Kurt.
No. Julie pointed at a point. When you look at the top part, you know, this is where it specifies the 5 years and so forth. But there's this exempt from B, C, and E because there's more. But you get to B, you know, look at paragraph 3, so that's the same thing. But when you get to home inspectors, it's not. There's nothing about the 5 years or anything that was referenced.
Ah.
So it needs that language in there, too, indicating you've been
a home inspector for 5 years.
Right.
And we can, again, talk about that in the HRSC, too, and feel like if you feel like that's the right number of years, you know, maybe it doesn't need to be 5 years. So we can talk about that and bring it back.
That'll be looked at in more detail. It doesn't have to look exactly like this right now.
That's no, but if you're going to take it to the Rules and Standards Committee, it'd be nice to have it.
Yeah.
Something to work off of like this.
Well, it will be. But if you want to work on it now, we can.
No, we got the Standards Committee work on it first, and then we'll bring it back here. We're coming back here shortly, right?
Yeah.
guess so.
Actually, yeah, I have one day. Seriously, you guys, September is insane with conferences. Monday the 19th is I think the only day in the entire month
of September
that Kurt and I will both be here.
That doesn't work for me. I have an in-car board of directors meeting that week. They might.
Is it all day?
It's in Pennsylvania. Oh, well, but you know what? It's, let me look, because it's not a, oh, you know what? That's a travel day. So I could call in.
Would you fly out one day early?
I'm actually going from an education committee meeting in Denver on Friday and Saturday, and I'm flying to Pennsylvania on Sunday. And then Monday was driving to the meeting site.
Okay. How's Monday the 19th for anybody?
I have a board of directors meeting I have to attend. But it's in the morning, so.
Is there any other day you can see? Because I can't see any other day that we would both be here. So
I'm gone that whole week, so that.
I mean, you could do it without me. Kurt's amazing. Like, while I'm at CLARB, September 20, 21, 22, 23. Any of the rest of that week.
I could do after.
My son gets married at the end of that week, so.
2021, I could do at 10
that
o'clock.
That better not miss.
Yeah.
What about the 21st at 10 o'clock? That's a Wednesday, September 21st at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Are you worried? Alejandro, Mike, does that work for you? Because the board meeting is the 27th, so if we need to meet again before, we're kind of almost out of time, but we can still send an amendment out on the 23rd, so we could meet on the 21st. But, I mean, you guys can. I'm going to be with the landscape architects. Report back to Leroy and Jack will be with me. I'm not hearing anything. Alejandro, are you on mute, or are you thinking? And Mike?
All right, I'm on mute. Yeah, I'm good with it. 21st works for me at 10.
21st of what?
September.
From 10 to 2.
Yeah, I don't think that's a problem.
If you guys come here, Kurt just said he'd buy pizza for everybody.
I don't see why I couldn't.
You sure that's allowed?
Out of our own pocket, sure. Yeah, we can do anything.
And that'll be a quicker meeting.
It should
right?
be. As long as we stay focused and don't go do all the other things we'd like to do, but stay focused
focus
these
right
matters
on the
at
package,
hand.
Package is going
to
go.
Focused on what we want to present to the board.
Yep.
And I want to make sure that I know what that is. Obviously, the definitions, obviously, the endorsement. Was there anything else already we wanted to focus on those two specifically?
And we'll be talking about what the home inspectors want to do on this.
Correct. Because the others were the home inspector, FAA stuff, alarms, fingerprint clearance card, cleanup renewal. We need to talk about that. Board composition.
Well, the board composition, I thought we decided was a good way to go.
I think we decided it's a good way to go. The question is, it'd be a separate bill.
Right, set it aside. Right.
And so when we do take it to the board, we should take it that way as being the recommendation.
So I would have the two bills. One bill is going to be our definitions and our endorsement, and one bill is going to be composition.
Yep.
Wasn't Dr. Angel talking about separating something else out of there, too? Other than just the board?
I don't think so, Mr. Lee. I was thinking just
the composition.
Yeah, the board composition.
Yes.
I think we can go to our board and say, look, we're looking to run this as a separate bill, but we're open to your input. If you think it should run together, let us know.
Yeah, okay, good.
Anything else to discuss for today?
I'm good. Any other
business for the good of the cause that's on the agenda.
You guys are troopers. You cannot even say how much we appreciate the meeting of the great minds to talk about these things. Thank you so much.
Well, we owe a lot to Kurt for putting in so much of it.
Yes, you guys did a great job, staff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And Hayden, all amazing. With five Hayden definitions of engineering.
He's our research genie.
I'm super impressed. I thought updating statutes the way you guys did was going to be like a months long effort that we would have to undertake, and you got this really far along with one try.
That's good. I agree.
All right. Yeah, thank you all for participating.
Entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make that motion.
Second?
I'll second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Everybody good? All right.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone. And those who just kind of watched and were silent, thank you. We appreciate you attending, and see everybody later.
Okay. Bye, y'all.
Thank you, Deanie.
Bye, everybody.
You're welcome. Bye.
Okay.